it's well known that you have a huge interest in the occult, and one of the largest collections of books of that.
I don't have a huge collection. Somebody wrote I had 20,000 books. I'd have to live in a bath. I have maybe 4 or 5. I have The Devil Rides Out, first edition, signed to me by Dennis Wheatley. There's a book just come out about him called The Devil is a Gentleman. And I have met people who claimed to be Satanists, who claimed to be involved with black magic. And I warn all of you, never, never, never. You will not only lose your mind, you lose your soul.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 6th of October 2023, streaming live from the PRSC Arts Centre in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream and at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey. Also live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores. Anything please but Google. I'm Tony Gosling, thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military grade propaganda psyops, puff pieces on the conspirators, hatchet jobs on the heroes, cancelling vote winners like Boris and Trump, while Big Pharma's Matt Hancock and Bill Gates' crimes against humanity have all been forgotten because there's an evil Putin has hijacked the news agenda. Albert Pike's accelerationist strategy, clear to anyone with eyes to see and ears to hear. The so-called solutions to every crisis, climate, migrant, COVID, economic Ukraine, are not designed to make things better, as the mass media is spinning them. They're just Armageddonist policies designed to make every crisis worse. And on the subject of Armageddon, we've got a terrific, well, I thought it was terrific. I learnt a lot myself. Fantastic guy, David Livingstone interview on his latest article, which is looking at the use of Class A drugs by the Central Intelligence Agency and the links between the occult and MK Ultra. Fascinating article, fascinating, I think. Anyway, UN Sustainable Development Goals are supposed to address the climate crisis and wealth inequality, but are they really just a race to the bottom? Anyway, helping navigate us through the Fourth Reich Matrix, the World Economics Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Martin, I think the obvious thing to talk about this week is the Conservative conference, the Labour conference about to start. But you know what? I'm quite certain that many people are just totally switched off from all of this.
Well, it's true that there's a depoliticisation effect. It depends, you know, where you are and who you are, but, you know, some people are just not interested in any of it, and also there's a general disgust with it all.
We're not talking about those, we're talking about people that try to get engaged with it to find out who to vote for, and now a lot of those people are just thinking, well, it makes no difference, so why bother?
Well, I certainly know that plenty of people in the who've left the Labour Party are very unhappy about the situation, and they're very politicised. I've been talking to some of them this week. They feel very disillusioned with the Starmer. At the same time, obviously, the Tory government are a shower. But there doesn't seem to be anything on the horizon to really, really support, other than to try and stop the rot in however way, whatever way you can.
I'd love you to just throw a bit of light on those conversations, if you can be frank about them, Martin. And what do people say to you about, you know, Martin, well, why don't you leave? And what do you say to them about, well, this is why I'm still in the Labour Party, even though it's a busted flush?
Well, in actual fact, some of the people I spoke to are still in it, and others, and I was talking to them about how many people have left. People like myself are not going to leave because, that's not what we're going to do. But lots of people who joined during the Corbyn era were very disillusioned. Like, a lot of people went and marched against the war in Iraq. And then when it didn't stop the war, they then thought, well, there's no point in marching. That's wrong. It's a wrong conclusion, but you can see why people would draw it.
So what about you and your reasons for staying in the Labour Party, even though, as I said, it's...
Because until we change the electoral system, Tony, there is no other mechanism for stopping the neoliberal project. That's all we've got, and it's pitiful, but that's the reality.
Yeah, so I thought actually we'd have a... Because a couple of weeks I've had the stuff on nuclear weapons sitting around. I haven't used it, so I'm going to start with that. But before I do, I'd just like to say something about the... Because we're going to go on to this, I'm sure, a bit later as well. This result up in Scotland. Actually, the by-election we were talking about last week, it turns out that this is a very clear message to the SNP. Their days are numbered, if not finished, and that Labour does stand a really good chance of winning in Scotland.
Well, I mean, if this particular by-election result was repeated at a general election, they're saying that Labour could get up to 40 seats, which if you think...
I think at the moment they've only got one, haven't they?
That's
right. The SNP has basically totally
The SNP took their seats completely. I mean, the SNP used to have its support in certain parts of Scotland, like Aberdeen and so on, but the central belt, Glasgow and around Glasgow, was solidly Labour when I used to go up there. The SNP had some councillors, but they were very much in the minority. But of course, what happened over many years is that gradually the SNP were able to eat into Labour's vote. Now, the Labour Party obviously would love for this by-election to be repeated at a general election, and it's very good news for Starmer and his crowd. Whether you like Starmer or not, it's good news for him, because what it means is they can now turn round to potential Tory voters who might vote Labour in England and say, look, we're not going to be beholden on the SNP to form a government, therefore you can vote for us in confidence and get a nice Conservative government. Look at me, I'll make the best Conservative Prime Minister ever, Sir Keir Starmer. And that's the pitch.
Is he going to win next year?
Well, it looks like it.
I mean, let me be a bit cynical here, because I look at this, you know, from, I suppose, almost like someone sitting on the moon looking down at Britain and in despair. And I wonder whether the powers that be have just thought to themselves, well, actually, Labour's not looking too good. They want Labour to win the next general election because they think that the Tories, I mean, the fact that the Tories have been in power so long rather makes it look as if we don't actually have a democracy, and they've run out of steam, so they've got to have another, you know, Team B has got to have a go for a few years. And but because Starmer is so hopeless and weak, and particularly not very good at live debating and answering difficult questions, that they've got to nobble the SNP in order to give Labour a chance of actually getting a majority, so that they wouldn't have to go into coalition with the SNP. Would you agree with that?
Well, it's quite possible, Tony, that the SNP are the anti-system party in terms of British politics overall, and it may well be that all the travails they've been put through, including the setup of Alex Salmond and so forth, is actually the intelligence services nobbling them to the benefit of the Labour Party, who are much more acceptable to big capital in this country.
Isn't it the difference between the sort of power in Edinburgh versus the power in London?
Well, the truth is there's not that much power in Edinburgh, and therefore the SNP are spoilers from the point of view of the
But the power in Edinburgh is the power in Edinburgh is supported internationally, isn't it? It's got they actually have got a very close relationship with Brussels, funnily enough.
Well, yes, they have, and obviously that's what you try and do. Like, Ireland has got a close relationship with Brussels, which is why there's a border in the Irish Sea as a result of all the negotiations, because that's what you get allies for, so that the Brits can't tell you what to do. Perfectly logical.
The BBC's Chris Mason has called the election result a thunderbolt. By-election transforms the political weather, he says. Labour's 17,845 votes in South Lanarkshire, in a nation of 5.4 million people, it's only one little. You're saying it's only a small thing, but the swing is enormous. I'm just trying to see. It says, "Oh yeah, a swing of 20.4% from the SNP to Labour." Now that is an enormous swing, isn't it? If that was to happen in the general election, you think that Labour may have a majority?
Well, they should get 40 seats, I understand, in Scotland.
Well, that may well help them, won't it?
Well, actually, yeah, of course, and also that's going to be a huge boost.
Those seats up in the north of England also are not going to be the red wall anymore, is it?
No, I mean, the Tories' only hope is a low turnout and the fact that they've pushed loads of people off the electoral registers as a result of these, you know, voter ID and so on. But actually, in a first-past-the-post system, that won't matter too much, because most of the people pushed off the electoral register will be in already Labour-voting constituencies, which will return a Labour MP anyway.
Have you been watching the Tory conference this week?
Oh, obviously, Tony, I've been tuning in and watching it every evening with great interest and hope. hope, yes.
Yeah, actually, quite a lot of the Tory MPs haven't even been bothering to do that, have they? It was a very low turnout. And also, of course, they don't show you on the television how many people are sitting in the audience. And I can tell you, I think Suella Braverman is going to be the next, once Rishi Sunak loses next year's general election, it looks like she's going to be the one to take over, because it was a packed hall. So Jeremy Hunt was almost empty, the hall, for his speech. I mean, just about as empty as his policy. Well, yeah, his policies are hopeless, really. It doesn't seem they've got anything to offer at all. In fact, his people like he and Grant Shapps have almost made a career out of having empty policies that they give great speeches about this, that and everything else, but they don't really deliver anything interesting or useful, and they've got no vision at all.
Well, I think the problem for the Tory party is if Labour does win the next general election, and it's quite possible under the first-past-the-post system that Starmer will have a majority, even though he doesn't get a majority of the votes, then the Tory party will fall into civil war.
Will you be happy about that? Well, you'll be crying. Oh, no, he shouldn't be Prime Minister, and you'll be screaming and shouting at him.
What would be the best result from my point of view is if he wins but doesn't get an overall majority, is that opens the system up. Yeah. But if that happens, it's a fluke, I'm afraid.
Is it feasible for Britain to go over to PR whilst we've got this? It may be the Greens. The SNP may possibly have begun to open that up. But if they're going to fail so terribly at the general election, would we have to wait for the Greens to come up before there's any change to the system?
I think both in Scotland and Wales, the elections to the National Assemblies are under PR, and that is not going to change. So that's continually going to be a thorn in the shoe of those who want the existing system to continue unchanged. I think what we will find is we're going to get a right-wing Labour government, which would be like a Tory government of the 1970s. Now, that might not be acceptable to a younger generation as we go into the biggest capitalist crisis of anybody's lifetime.
No, it might well not. Peter Mandelson is going to be the guy in charge, and Tony Blair.
They're pulling the strings from behind the scenes, undoubtedly.
We've been seeing a lot of these ex-prime ministers, haven't we, talking about all these various policies. And, of course, there's also King Charles. And all these people we don't elect or we get rid of, and we'd rather get rid of if we had the chance to, seem to be making rather too many of the decisions, whilst the politicians just sit there, behave themselves and do what they're told. Anyway, on to nukes now. And what prompted this, for me, was the... Al Jazeera piece, a brilliant Al Jazeera. Actually, no, was it France? No, it was France 24 piece on the Spanish incident at Palomares. Now, Martin, I'm not sure if you... I mean, it's 1966 this happened, but is anything you know before we hear their piece about this? This is 5 minutes or so, or 3 minutes, a clip from it, about the Palomares incident. It was where a B-52, American nuclear-armed B-52, crashed in mid-air with a refueling tanker. The whole thing exploded, and these four nuclear bombs just dropped down on the Spanish near the Spanish coast.
Well, I remember the incident. I don't remember the incident at the time, but obviously I know of the incident. And, of course, these things are actually... You know, if you carry on having nuclear weapons year in, year out, eventually something like this is going to happen.
Well, isn't it great, I think, that France 24 did this? I mean, obviously, the French have got a slightly different attitude to US nukes, haven't they, than the rest of the European media or the world?
Well, that's true to some extent, but of course, you know, in France, they've still got an establishment oriented towards the main deep state in the West.
Prepared to pick at a few scabs that the Americans have put, and particularly this one over in Spain. So Palomares is a little village. In 1966, a B-52 armed with four hydrogen bombs was flying overhead and being refueled, and there was an accident up there. The tanker burst into flames and the B-52 broke up, and these four bombs landed on this little farm back in 1966.
We feel we've been tricked because this has gone on for years now, since 2007. First, they stopped my father from working on his land. We were in shock back then, asking ourselves, what do we do now? Then they rented our land from us for years, and we thought, well, now they're going to do something. And now suddenly they just close the chapter and requisition the land and do it for a ridiculous price, after all the steps we've been through, after everything they've put him through, to be paying him €1 a square metre.
All the years I've worked, and to finish up being swindled. Marta's hoping she can help Martin win compensation of 70,000 euros, four times what the Spanish state has proposed. It was a lie to say for 3 years they were going to examine the land with a view to cleaning it. That went on until 2021. In other words, they ensured Martin's land lost absolutely all its value before deciding to expropriate it by telling him he couldn't make any appeal. The only factor taken into account to value the land was its current worth. And today it's practically worthless. Martin showed us his 1.2 hectare plot.
I used to keep 870 sheep here. They took them away for nothing. Look at the state of the land. The day they took my sheep away, I cried like a baby. You have no idea how much they've made me suffer.
Jose studied these declassified documents and published a research paper in a specialist journal. He cites the studies carried out by CIMAT between 1966 and 1988.
The European Union's exposure limit for a person for any artificial radioactivity is currently 1 millisievert per year. The residents of Palomares, who were the most exposed to it, received between 150 and 200 times more than what we should receive in a year. It's absolutely essential that we have a proper clean-up, not the one that was carried out in 1966. As long as they don't do that, there will still be a risk to residents.
Earlier this year, Joe Biden pledged to pursue negotiations with Spain on an agreement to clean up the contaminated land. Those living in Palomares want action, particularly before US presidential elections next year.
Well, fingers crossed on that one, Martin. So the Americans have really just, rather than apologise to the Spanish, come in and done a complete clear-up operation for leaving these. I mean, what happened was, I believe, two of the nuclear weapons didn't explode, but the other two did. They weren't armed, so that just meant that what effectively you got was two enormous dirty bombs landing on this guy's farm.
Yeah, well, I wonder whether you can clean that stuff up. I mean, you talk about cleaning it up. How do you clean up radioactive poisoning like that?
Yeah, it's basically, and the part of Spain that it's in is on the east coast, down sort of down near Gibraltar direction, tiny little village. But I find it amazing that so little of this, you know, we don't get the environmentalists talking about this sort of thing. What you've got there is a whole farm, which is just total poison, and I'd like to see the environmentalists making a bit more of a fuss about this. I mean, the guy himself, the farmer Martin, and they're saying that the contamination levels around there are around about 200 times the maximum allowed for radiation. This is just been, the idea is just to sweep it under the carpet, isn't it?
Well, it is sweeping it under the carpet, but I also come back to what I said a minute ago, how do you clean that up? You can't, actually. You're stuck with it.
What you have to do, and it's a bit like the Fukushima disaster, isn't it? You have to go digging down, until you start to find some soil which is not contaminated. And it may be that due to rainfall, because they've left it such a long time, that there's a fantastic amount more of the soil that's now been contaminated with all these radioactive isotopes, elements and whatever, that have been left by these dirty bombs. But the fact of the matter is, it's a political thing, isn't it, really? This is the Americans deciding that we are going to refuel our nuclear-armed bombers over your heads.
Yes, and of course, Portugal was in NATO at the time and was a fascist state.
Well, this is Spain.
It may well be that the B-52s flew from the Azores or somewhere like that.
Well, they were flying, yeah, down the Mediterranean, I would imagine, and refueling along the Mediterranean on their way down probably to the Caucasus or somewhere like that.
Yeah, we can
only
guess.
Spain would have been Franco Spain, wouldn't it?
It would have been Franco Spain, but I'm thinking about this. I don't think Spain was in NATO, but Portugal was definitely in NATO as a fascist dictatorship.
It all helps to remind us, I suppose, about this push now to get more nuclear weapons here in the UK.
Well, everybody should be thinking about the dangers of nuclear war, because we're as close as we've ever been since the Cuban Missile Crisis. But of course, you know, people haven't really, you know, because it's been around for so long, you get to the point where people think, well, that's not going to happen. Whereas in actual fact, of course, in the 1960s, people were suddenly confronted with the fact that could happen. And, you know, and of course the other thing about it is all these nuclear weapons are inevitably going to cause accidents one way or another eventually. Of course they are.
The more of them you have, the more chance there is of an accident. And also, the more brinksmanship you pursue, such as what's going on in Ukraine, the more likely there is to be an accidental use or maybe even
That's right.
a use of them on purpose. So the closer they come to being armed. It's funny, isn't it? Because back in the 1950s, you had all these things like the Aldermaster marches, when nuclear weapons policy was first being implemented by Labour and Tory governments after the war. There was a massive kickback by civil society. Now, nothing.
Well, it's what I was saying earlier. What happens is people get used to the threat. And they just presume, like a younger generation, are possibly more worried about climate change than they are about nuclear war.
Yeah, interesting.
That is wrong.
Yeah, because so
in actual
wrong,
fact, nuclear war is a much more present threat.
Yeah, they
not
should...
saying that climate change isn't, but you need to think
well,
about
never
what's,
mind
really,
global warming.
What's really the problem.
Never mind global warming. What about a nuclear winter, mate?
Yes, indeed.
And also the normalisation of nuclear weapons. To begin with, that most of the nuclear fleet was up in Scotland, way out, you know, west of Glasgow, Faslane and Coalport. But now you have quite a sizable base in England, down in Plymouth at Devonport. And I dug up this recording we made back in 2002 down in Plymouth of a, I thought, fascinating lecture by the nuclear engineer John Large. He was one of the people who was involved in designing the Magnox power stations. He died a couple of years ago, but here he is talking about the... he was a critic of the government and the Navy and the nuclear industry's various... safety protocols. So they say, oh, we're going to make sure that it's all safe, and we're going to have an exercise, and we're going to have a safety protocol, we're going to look at the risk. And what he pointed out was that there's loads of things you haven't even bothered to look at all. And actually, what you're doing is you're massively massaging down the risk. The risks are that there's all sorts of things that may well happen that you haven't even considered. So here he is looking at the Devonport nuclear safety in a lecture in 2002, and he says, well, what they're doing is they're really looking at much of the refueling of the nuclear submarines, because they've got a nuclear reactor in there that powers them. But what if they had an accident with one of the Trident nuclear weapons that's on them? What about that?
I just want to briefly talk about nuclear weapons on the premise that these boats are capable of carrying nuclear weapons. What we're interested in, I'll just go back and... I should never show you anything like this. All top secret. This is a nuclear weapon. The top bit's the thermo device, the hydrogen device. The little ball in the middle is a fission device. That's going to interest in a fission device. And so we're interested in this football size thing. It's about this size. The whole weapon's about the size of a long waste paper bin. This football size thing contains the plutonium inside. We can do this now. We'll have a look inside. Close your eyes if you're a loyal citizen. The assembly is made up like this. It's a wonderful slide, this. The plutonium, hollow plutonium sphere is inside, is wrapped in a series of tampers, but importantly, high explosives. This is the plutonium sphere here. It's got some bits and pieces inside. These are high explosive charges that serve to compress, these are shape charges, coalesce and compress on this sphere to force it down to about the size of a pea, at which it goes supercritical and creates a fissile nuclear detonation. Well, The risk here is not of a nuclear detonation. There is a risk, but not a very significant one, is a fire inside a missile silo, the explosives going off or frazzling, burning, and then the plutonium, because it's a pure metal, will actually burn itself. And if you're burning plutonium, producing plutonium oxide, a very finely divided oxide, and that means a tiny speck size, which is enough to actually enter the respiratory system and then be reconcentrated on the skeletal frame in your liver and in your gonads. And of course, that represents a very significant intake indeed. And all the ERL systems just don't work for it. You have to offer immediate respiratory protection, a mask, to all the people in the area. Now the Americans, oh sorry, this is the next wonderful slide, showing the release of plutonium. And this comes out the cloud and you breathe it in. The old American standard, the maximum tolerable body burden of plutonium-239, is highly fissile material used in nuclear weapons, was 1/10 of 1/1,000,000 of 1 gram. So that's how much an individual was considered to tolerate before there was a significant health impact. 1/10 of 1/1,000,000 of 1 gram. Typical weapon contains about 5 to 8 kilograms of plutonium. Obviously not all of those 1/10, 1/1,000,000, 1/10 of a gram will actually disperse like that, but nevertheless, you can see just one weapon burning, aerosolizing, distributing in the atmosphere and coming down on a city this size could have a very significant health impact in the interim and longer terms. The Americans, faced with this accident, their standard manuals for accidents involving nuclear weapons would be rather like this. Immediate evacuation for about 2, 3, 4 kilometres, depending on the site commander's information. Respiratory protection, masks, high filter masks, keepers, and sheltering, and then sheltering possibly out as far as 40 to 50 kilometres. So that's, in short, the consequences of a nuclear weapon accident occurring in the dockyard, irrespective of whether the Ministry of Defence confirm or deny. Incidentally, all this data comes from British tests carried out in Maralinga in Australia in the late 50s, early 60s, called the Vixen test, where they deliberately burnt nuclear weapons, subjected to accidents like lorry fires, aircraft crashes, to see what the effect was. And at Maralinga, they found that the respiratory safeguards, where you needed protection from uptake, respiratory uptake, varied between 17 to 34 miles. And that was in the 50s, 60s, when the limits were somewhat different. So, one more thing, this is a lovely slide, this, well, it's a bit macabre, it's got some sounds on this one, oh, you can't hear them now. One more thing, it's terrorist attack, terrorism, and what I'm going to say about this, I wrote to the MOD and asked them whether the report of assessment, that's the one they send to the health and safety executive, contains DBTs, design basis threats. Do they take account of terrorist attacks? Because the city of Plymouth, I put to you, would have to understand the nature of the accident, the incident, or the event to be able to counter it. So do they take account of terrorism? These are the answers I got. Well, the Minister of Defence said, this was their reply, which I'm going to just briefly put down here, was, the report of assessment is confidential. Ah. And there's no need to specifically plan for terrorist attack. And anyway, the countermeasure zone, the pre-plan, is extendable to cover terrorist attack.
Wow.
So, not deterred, I whipped off a quick letter to the Home Office to operate this very odd committee called the Chemical, Biological, Radiological and Nuclear Committee, whose membership is secret. And they said to me, well, the DBTs, the design-based threats, are confidential. We can't tell you those. So I said, well, who do you tell? Well, we can't tell you that. And the CBRN, well, that's secret as well. So I thought, well, not giving up. I said to one of my dogs, to Jack Russell, well, what would you do? He said, oh, I'm a terrier, I'd go for it. Really go for it. No. So I wrote to the DTI, their nuclear security unit. And they said, you've already received these answers from the MOD and the Home Office. Go away. We're not going to answer. The problem is no one is prepared to discuss terrorist attacks in this country. Of course, Devonport Dockyard, is the naval base of the Trafalgar-class submarines that were used in the Afghanistan attacks. They were one of the first submarines to fire cruise missiles into Afghanistan. So clearly, people in Afghanistan will be somewhat peeved and would certainly look towards Devonport as being a centerpiece.
Well, that's the wonderful, glorious, lovely guy. Very, very forthright. So puts you in your place if you get anything wrong. I always remember him telling me, well, if you think that these radioactive fuel rods that are going up to Sellafield are relatively harmless, if there was one on a playing field and you were to run and jump over it, you'd be dead before you got to it. That's how radioactive they are and that's how deadly they are. But he had a fantastic way of putting things into everyday language, Martin, like this idea of the hydrogen bomb on a Trident submarine is basically about the size of a large waste paper bin.
Yeah, I met him years ago and I worked for the New Economics Foundation. I remember one phrase that he used in our little conversation was, if you knew what I knew, you'd shiver in your shoes. And one of the things he told me about is that there's a Russian nuclear submarine at the bottom of the North Sea, which is so far deep down that nobody knows how to rescue it. It's got nuclear reactors and nuclear weapons on it. And as long as the hull remains, you know, unrusted, it'll be okay to leave it there. Because, of course, it won't come out. But, of course, nobody can get it out, because any attempt to get it out would leave it and lead to it crumbling. And, therefore, it's sitting there, like, just waiting to leak into the North Sea and destroy the fisheries, etc., etc. And, of course, we've seen what's happened at Fukushima with the release of this water from the nuclear reactors there. And that's led to an immediate ban on in the Chinese market of all Japanese fish products.
That may just be political, mightn't it?
Well, it may just be political, but it may also be that this, as I was saying earlier when we were talking about the Palmares incident, the problem with nuclear weaponry and nuclear power is there's no easy way to put the genie back in the bottle once you've let it out. You can say, well, we're going to clean it up. How are you going to clean it up? It's not that straightforward, is it?
Yeah, I mean, the other thing, of course, is now Putin has got all these rather nice hypersonic weapons. It doesn't even have to be a nuke. One of those was to hit one of the nuclear submarines in Devonport. I mean, it just seems to me that actually having nuclear weapons and nuclear submarines in a city like Plymouth is just, well, it's reckless, really, reckless.
Well, this is one. The SNP's position, of course, has always been that if they came to power in an independent Scotland, they would close Faslane. That has always been their position. But, of course, that's now on the back burner, and I'm quite sure that's not Keir Starmer's
policy. Well, it certainly won't be, will it? No chance of that. I'm just looking at the population of Plymouth. It's around about 250, that's a quarter of a million people. It just seems that they don't care. And actually, what the other thing is, not only do the Minister of Defence and the people making these decisions not care about the quarter of a million people who live in Plymouth, putting out a whole bunch of nuclear submarines. I mean, I remember them saying recently that we had visits in the 1970s from submarines here in the port of Bristol. But they won't do it anymore because they've only got nuclear-powered ones. Well, so they won't bring them into Bristol, but they'll actually leave them for years and actually dismantle them and mothball them in the middle of Plymouth. So it's total double standards. There are other naval bases, I'm sure, around that are well away from populations, but these things are... So they're weapons, but then they get mothballed, they get left there for years, and they're mega-toxic.
Yes, and of course the thing is that the campaign for nuclear disarmament always made the case that Britain should unilaterally nuclear disarm. Nobody suggested that the Russians or the Americans should unilaterally nuclear disarm. What you want is countries like China, Russia and the US are quite geographically isolated from each other. If they've got ICBMs that can hit each other, then people have got plenty of time to see them coming and discuss what's happening so that you don't get the chance of accidents. But little countries like us having them is just a nuisance. We would never use, if we ever use them, it'd be a disaster.
What's the point of having them? Hangover from the legacy of empire.
Well, of course it is. Both France and Britain had nuclear weapons because they didn't want to be upstaged by the Americans. And of course, what's happened in recent years is that all of the treaties to control the proliferation of nuclear weapons have just been ripped up by the West. So the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty was ripped up by Trump, and that basically said no short-range missiles in Europe. And that was a way of making sure that you couldn't just have, you know, because we're now in a situation with missiles in Poland and Romania and potentially in Ukraine, where the Russians have got to face less than 5 minutes to make a decision about whether this missile is nuclear or not, in which case they're just going to go straight to DEFCON 1 and retaliate. We could easily have an accidental missile exchange, and the way you avoid that is by making sure that the countries with nuclear weapons are a long way away from each other, and there's plenty of negotiation going on, everybody else out of the game.
So if you care about these things, which I do, Martin does, anyone with half a brain does, anyone with children does, anyone that's, yeah, I mean, you've got to, really. The CND, Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament's Policy Conference 2023 is taking place, where is it, on, well, there's something going on Saturday the 7th of October, CND's AGM, but there's another conference of some kind, that's right, the Public Policy Conference on Saturday the 28th of October. Quite where it is, let's have a look. At least it's nice to know that CND is still chugging along. In fact, they do quite a good job here in Bristol. It's in Manchester, actually. So that's over the in a few weeks' time. And actually, tomorrow is their AGM. So if you're a member of CND, that's where you go and put your input in. But what do you make of the modern CND, Martin?
Well, I mean, CND has gone through phases of mass mobilization, and then, you know, people move on to other issues, but it's always there.
I think it was the first march I ever went on in London. It must have been in the late 70s, early 80s.
Well, the 80s, they got a massive boost in the 80s because of the campaign against cruise missiles. And now, of course,
which was infiltrated, by the way.
Well, of course, everything's infiltrated, Tony. We all know that. But the point is that in that era, people were very aware that using short-range missiles in Europe could trigger a disaster. And eventually, what was agreed between Gorbachev and Reagan is that all short-range missiles would be removed from the European theatre. And then the Trump ripped that up. They've ripped up the Open Skies Treaty, which allows both sides to observe each other's silos and so on. And the START negotiations treaty, the ABM treaty was ripped up, which stopped people trying to develop short-range missiles to shoot down incoming missiles. All of this infrastructure of arms control, which of course then led people to see, you know, breathe a sigh of relief, you know, the collapse of the Berlin Wall, peace with Russia, it all seemed as if it was going in the right direction. So of course CND's valency went down. But of course in recent years, the West, and it is the West, it's not the Russians, the West has ripped up all of that arms control negotiated treaties. And we've negotiated those treaties with the communist Soviet Union, but we've ripped them up with modern democratic Russia. I mean, what sense does that make? And it doesn't make any sense. And the Russians have rightly drawn the conclusion that the West is hostile and belligerent and reckless in relation to these things.
Gloucestershire nuclear test victims are told by the Conservative Veterans Minister. Okay, so if you're a veteran that's not left on the street homeless, begging, then you may be one that's had a real hard time because of being used as a guinea pig in those tests back in the 1950s. The Gloucestershire nuclear test victims told by the Conservative Veteran Minister, oh, well, why don't you just sue the Ministry of Defence? Plymouth MP Johnny Mercer has urged the nuclear veterans to sue the Ministry of Defence.
And is he going to support them to sue the Ministry of Defence? Or is that just a cheeky, you know, go away and die remark?
It sounds like a cheeky go away and die remark. It's like, basically, you're not going to get any help from me. I mean, you're not going to have the Veterans Ministry, whoever that is, part of the MOD, suing another part of the MOD, are you? It's not going to happen.
Well, obviously,
I mean, who's the permanent secretary going to divide himself in two and start walking off in two different directions? They're being given a fob off, basically, aren't they?
Yes.
Anyway, they will pursue this, so let's have a listen to the news from last week about this particular topic.
Veterans who took part in the UK's nuclear weapons tests in the 1950s and 1960s are attempting to relaunch a battle for compensation a decade after being legally blocked from suing the government. Campaigners say newly discovered documents suggest military officers may have had suspicions that personnel suffered radioactive damage. More than 22,000 military staff worked on detonations in Australia and the South Pacific. Here's our home and legal correspondent, Dominic Casciani.
For decades, personnel who witnessed the nuclear bomb tests in the 1950s and 60s have believed that later illnesses, including cancer and birth defects in their children, could be blamed on radiation damage. There were virtually no safety precautions on the ground. Some plane precautions flew through the mushroom clouds. Judges told the men in 2012 they had run out of time to sue, but recently discovered documents have convinced campaigners they have another chance. The files suggest military chiefs kept blood and urine records in secret archives, tracking the health of the bomb test witnesses. Eric Barton and other members of the campaign are determined to go back to court. Now aged 82, he witnessed six nuclear bomb tests and is appalled at how he and his comrades have been treated.
Guinea pigs, that's all they were. The British government turned round to you and say, you prove it. We are finding documents that are proving that the government have been lying and they're covering everything up.
The government says there's no link between the tests and ill health and says individual medical records have always been accessible. Steve Peirce's late father was present at tests and he was later born with disabilities. He's been denied access to his father's blood tests and wants to know if radiation caused genetic damage passed to him in the womb.
We know he was exposed to radiation and I have obvious disabilities. What was he exposed to? Because my condition is actually undiagnosed. Having access to these medical records and blood samples might help us determine whether that is the case.
From today, the campaign group aims to sign up as many as 1,500 surviving veterans for the planned court case. The Ministry of Defence said it couldn't comment on potential legal action.
Oh, I bet it can't, because it's got, not got a leg to stand on, as usual. The crux of this, Martin, is that they, even though they've gone past the legal age where they're allowed to sue them, they've discovered that the government lied, funnily enough. In fact, the Ministry of Defence lied by tracking their health data using things like blood samples and urine samples, but they kept that whole thing secret from the lawyers originally. So now, because they've kept it secret, they're saying that, that it gives them the opportunity to reopen the case, and that maybe it does.
Well, let's hope so. And, of course, what it means when they were checking up on them was that they knew very well that there was a danger of damage, and what they're doing is checking to see what happens, you know, because what they want to know is...
Oh, let's have a look at your children. Are they look? Have they got missing an arm?
Yes, that's right. So, in other words, they're experimenting on them because they want to see what the effects of it are so that they can then decide, you know, various things they might want to decide in terms of using them and deploying them. It was all in a good cause, of course.
Well, yeah, supposedly. Yeah, so quite... I mean, obviously, to have a nuclear weapon at the end of the Second World War could have been really decisive if the Nazis, for example, had developed one and they were to threaten and actually use a nuke on London.
Well, I mean, we've all been living in the nuclear shadow since Hiroshima and Nagasaki, haven't we? I mean, the current situation is extremely worrying. As I've tried to explain earlier, the possibility, this is why, one of the main reasons why the Russians have gone to war, they've got various reasons, but one of them is we can't have a situation where you've got short-range missiles in Europe which are right in our face. We can't possibly tolerate that. If the Americans had short-range Russian missiles in Mexico, they wouldn't tolerate it. If the Russians put missiles in Cuba, they wouldn't tolerate it. They nearly ended the world in 1962. But supposedly, the Russians have got to put up with missiles in Poland, Romania, and possibly in Ukraine, which have got a flight time to Moscow of less than 5 minutes. They can't tolerate it, and they're not going to tolerate it. They've made it clear that they're going to stop that from happening by taking military action. And unless we back down, they're going to make sure that they do that. They're not going to have that in their face. They're not going to tolerate it.
Anyway, thankfully, we're living in a thriving, happy, healthy democracy, and it's been the glorious occasion of the Conservative Party conference this week, starting on Sunday and running through till the middle of the week. Let's have a listen to, I suppose, you know, with Rishi Sunak, I always feel like he's a used car salesman. He's trying to sell you something. He's getting very enthusiastic about something that doesn't actually mean anything. And even if it did mean anything, he would had no intention of doing it. So, yeah, but the, you know, obviously not all used car salesmen are as bad as Rishi Sunak sounds. But and some of them are reasonably honest. Although, you know, you can see, I think, the analogy. Let's have a listen to the the sales pitch that he's putting in for the public here, particularly looking at the aims that he, because he hasn't got long, the most a year until he has to call a general election, so which he's almost certain to lose. Although Boris, if they'd kept him on, would almost certainly, well, may well have won.
No, he wouldn't. He's delusionary.
Well, no, he may well have done.
Liz Truss could have walked just it.
Just a minute, Martin. You know. You look at the. You have to look at people's individual approval ratings.
His individual approval rating went through the floor. They just lost three by-elections.
No, it didn't, actually.
All right.
No, it didn't. Right, there was a lot of people that didn't buy all this Partygate stuff. And
I'd be perfectly
anyway.
Happy to go head-to-head with Boris Johnson at the next general election.
Well, I'm sure you would. Yeah, but you ain't going to get a chance. But
no?
he was a very high approval rating. The Tories ditched him. This is one of the reasons
they
I say,
ditched
isn't
him because his approval rating had gone through the floor.
No, that's not why. No, they ditched him because they ditched him. They decided to ditch him.
Tony, listen, we're not going to agree about this, so let's just put it on one side.
Well, just let me finish my sentence then.
I think you're just factually wrong there.
No, I'm not factually wrong. His approval rating was very high, actually. Much higher than... In fact, Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak were around about half of the approval rating, both of them, that Boris was. But then they decided we're going to ditch Boris anyway.
They just lost two by-elections in the Tory heartland by a massive, massive majority. There was no way they could go on with him.
Well, who cares? I mean,
who cares? He's dead now. Well, he's out of the game.
He's
now.
Dead. He is.
Well,
yes,
hopefully, he'll be dead soon enough after the warmongering he's done in the Ukraine. Absolutely disgraceful.
Well, of course. But would have Starmer have done any different?
He wouldn't.
Oh, Keir Starmer would never have gone to Ukraine and stopped the peace talks. No. He just didn't do
Well, that's
like
one
that.
Of the problems we've got, isn't it? That nobody would have gone and stopped the peace talks.
My point is that Sunak is a Goldman Sachs saboteur of the Tory party. And even some of the Tory party members, I think, understand that very well. Let's have a listen to his aims.
Today, I will set out how we will achieve this, beginning with a set of long-term decisions to build a brighter future for our children and to fundamentally change our country. And conference, you can already see my approach in the course I charted on net zero. And we Conservatives love our natural world. We are determined to be good stewards of it. In my own constituency, it is the beauty of the North York Moors and Swaledale and Wensleydale that makes the place home. We Conservatives also value frankness and consent. We believe that politicians have a duty to treat household budgets with respect and that change only endures if we bring people with us. As you could tell by the reaction to my decision to chart a new course to net zero, it was not the easiest argument to have. But when I looked at the reality of what people were being asked to do, the thousands of pounds people would need to pay, all of that disproportionately falling on the poorest in society, by the way, and all of it not actually necessary in those timeframes to meet our net zero targets, and in spite of us doing more than any other country, I concluded it simply wasn't right. So I decided to take a pragmatic, proportionate, and realistic approach to reaching net zero. And I won't take any lectures from other countries that have done far less than us, or from those for whom spending thousands of pounds means nothing. Change is difficult, particularly for those who disagree. But remember this, we will still meet our international obligations. We will still meet our domestic targets, and we will still get to net zero by 2050. We have solved a problem and offered an unapologetic defence of good conservative common sense.
So there's so so-called Prime Minister. Okay. So his big thing is over the last few weeks, he's just sort of toned down this whole net zero thing a bit, Martin. It's not going to be really enough. There are major issues out there. For example, the National Health Service is falling apart. You've got an enormous increase in knife crime on our streets. And obviously you've got this massive economic disaster taking place in sort of slow motion. But he doesn't really seem to get it at all. There's nothing in there on any of those issues. What there is on health, on the NHS, is this apparent sort of copying it's a copying of Jacinda's policy in New Zealand of saying people won't be able to smoke every year. It's going to increase the age 1 year, which means that somebody who is 25 will be able to buy a cigarette, but someone who's 24 won't. I mean, this is just a joke. It's not going to work. And this is what he's offering us on health. Nothing whatsoever on the NHS. It just seems to me that this was his last chance to do anything. And maybe he didn't even want to win. Maybe he and his chums at Tory Central Office don't actually want to win the next general election anyway.
I don't think that's true. I think they do, but they just don't know how. But I tend to agree with you on the smoking thing, because I didn't really agree with what they did in New Zealand. Because once you ban something, you create the possibility of black markets. And therefore, people are going to, you know, the age groups that want to smoke. Obviously, I wouldn't want to be encouraging people to smoke. Absolutely not. But on the other hand, I'm in favour of legalisation of all drugs, Tony. So we can't really ban tobacco at the same time as legalising everything else. It's not rational to me. On the question of net zero, leaving aside whether it's a good or a bad idea, I think what he's going to find is that in the constituents where the Lib Dems are breathing down their neck in the southeast of England and in the southwest of England, that is going to go down like a lead balloon, because they all believe in climate change and there needs something to be done about it. So he's going to lose votes there quite dramatically. The Liberal Democrats will be very happy with that.
What about Labour, though?
Well, Labour are put on the reason why he's done this is to put Labour on the spot. Because they know that their red wall voters generally agree that that net zero is not really a good idea. But on the other hand, they're more middle class supporters in major cities. They think it is. Now, leaving aside whether net zero is a bad or a good thing, I'm just talking about the politics, the cephology, the demography of it. So by moving in this direction, he's trying to shore up Tory support on the right, because they're very hostile to the whole idea. But it's not necessarily going to be an electoral winner in the constituencies that he needs to retain. And it may well be that he's going to lose out on as a result of that.
So last week we were talking about this whole net zero business, which is obviously a major decision that they're making here. And what I did is I said I'd dig out something which looks at UK per capita carbon emissions. So who are the worst polluters in the world? The fact of the matter is I did dig that graph out, and I put it up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Britain is 10th in the world per capita carbon emissions, and they are behind all the main countries you'd expect, like China, USA.
China won't be GDP per capita, they'll be lower than
this. This is carbon emissions per capita we're talking about.
Chinese carbon emissions per capita cannot be more than the UK. I don't believe that,
really?
Tony. Of course not. They've got a billion people. It's ridiculous.
Canada, hang on. So I'll just try and open that up in a minute. Just explain to me what you think about per capita.
If per capita emissions is a better, as you said last week, is a better measure than which countries are emitting the most. Because obviously, you know, some countries are quite relatively small in population, but they emit a great deal more carbon than poorer countries with much bigger populations. I mean, that's common sense. Everybody kind of understands that, surely. It's okay, wealthier people who make most per capita make the most contribution to carbon emissions for obvious reasons.
Britain is 10 in the world, 12, 13, 14. China is 15th in the world.
There you go. Well, that's okay. So
the top ones are who?
I imagine the US is up at the top somewhere.
They are. Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it, I think, just to get some of these figures. If I can actually read this thing. Canada is another very high one. South Korea, Australia, Japan, Germany, Russia, Iran, and then the UK. So that's where we figure. And all those other countries are going to have to reduce their emissions before we do.
Well, I mean, there's nobody's going to reduce any emissions, because we're having a third world war with China and Russia, and they're not going to cooperate on anything we may decide to do. So it's hardly what we should do if we want to help the third world to develop without creating too much carbon emissions is get rid of all their debts. But we're not doing that. We're actually increasing interest rates, which is going to push them into a crisis very soon.
So I'll put the link.
So there is going to be no hope of managing any of this.
I'll put the link up to the per capita emissions report, which, you know, it's annoying when the Daily Express puts China up the top because it's just massive, even though actually it's way below Britain.
Yes, well, it's a deliberate manipulation.
Yes, of course
isn't it?
It is. Yes, oh yeah, of course it is. India is very high on the total, but actually quite low on the per capita. I just find it, you know, interesting how you can mess around with statistics. So I'm going to put that graph up for you again this week, so you can see just how the Daily Express is massaging the facts.
As I said last week, the other thing you've got to take into account is historic emissions, not current emissions, and that doesn't cover that.
No, hang on a minute. No, you don't have to take.
No,
that
you
into
do.
Effect.
Because
no, you don't.
Because there's
you
a don't. Build-up of CO2
idea.
In the atmosphere,
just a minute,
which
Martin.
Didn't start yesterday.
Just a minute, Martin. You are not responsible for the emissions of people from the 1950s. The idea that it's somehow your fault, you know, this is these are emissions that have been going around the world anyway.
Tony, the main debate going on in the world.
This is a maybe there are people who are saying, well, because such and such a country emitted some carbon 200 years ago, that they are the ones that are going to have to make sure that they're not allowed to emit any carbon. It's beyond a joke.
I'm telling you, Tony, that all of the negotiations that have gone on at all the international meetings have taken that as a given.
No, they don't.
And I'm afraid
they have. No, they haven't.
They haven't, Tony.
Many of these decisions which were made a long time ago may have done. But
current negotiations are not just current emissions, Tony. They're not. It's just factually wrong.
Historic emissions
are being included.
Well, yes.
Now, then there's a second point I want to make.
Over a certain period of time.
Yes, indeed. The Industrial Revolution in Britain means that we've got a higher standard of living because we've had an Industrial Revolution.
Right. So we've got a lower standard of living as
a
result.
We can still have a decent standard of living, but other people have got to be allowed to have Industrial Revolutions as well.
Well, I agree.
As the Chinese will insist.
I agree with that.
The other thing, the other point I would make, Tony.
You're punishing countries or punishing individuals for emissions that were made before they were born is utterly insane.
Well, it's
and
also,
if anyone is making decisions based on that and you're trying to justify
Tony, so are you. Well, I am trying to justify
it
because that's the main basis of these discussions that are going
on.
Well,
that's why the discussions are going to go nowhere then.
Well, they're not going to go anywhere if we've got the attitude. The Chinese are going to say, if we're not allowed to industrialise, we're not talking to you at all. Okay, you've got to accept that you've made most of the mess, and we will help you sort it out.
In fact, in a way, the Chinese are being very polite about all this.
They are indeed,
because this is quite obviously an attack on them.
Yes, indeed, and they're being very polite about it,
especially when they're down way below Britain on the per capita carbon emissions.
Indeed, they are. And the other thing, of course, is that China's production, a lot of it ends up in our supermarkets, so it's actually our carbon footprint, not theirs. They don't consume the stuff they produce; they sell it to us. We can consume it. The consumers, especially the very wealthy consumers in the Western world, are the main problem. And what we probably need is a world war and a lot of those people got rid of, and then we'd be able to solve the problem. But there's going to be no discussion about any of this because we're going to war with China and Russia, and therefore there's nothing to discuss about climate change.
This is the sort of maniacal proposal that I'd expect from someone that's totally given up on any hope of democracy, Martin. Is that you?
No, I'm just pointing out that there's going to be no agreement about any of this while we've got a conflictual situation in the international system. Nobody in China is going to make any sacrifices to help Britain bring down carbon emissions while we're trying to overthrow their government. Same with the Russians.
We'll be hearing a bit more about that at the end of the show with David Livingstone and why that might be. But anyway, let's go back to Rishi Sunak, because his big announcement this week was all about HS2.
I am cancelling the rest of the HS2 project. And in its place, we will reinvest every single penny, £36 billion, in hundreds of new transport projects in the North and the Midlands across the country. This means £36 billion of investment in the projects that will make a real difference across our nation. As a result of the decision we are taking today, every region outside of London will receive the same or more government investment than they would have done under HS2, with quicker results. No government has ever developed a more ambitious scheme for northern transport than our new Network North. This is the right way to drive growth and spread opportunity across our country, to level up. With our new Network North, you will be able to get from Manchester to the new station in Bradford in 30 minutes, Sheffield in 42 minutes, and to Hull in 84 minutes on a fully electrified line. There's more. We'll protect the £12 billion to link up Manchester and Liverpool as planned, and we'll engage with local leaders on how best to deliver that scheme. We'll build the Midlands Rail Hub, connecting 50 different stations. We'll help Andy Street extend the West Midlands Metro. We'll build the Leeds Tram. We'll electrify the North Wales Main Line, upgrade the A1, the A2, the A5, the M6. We'll connect. There is more. There's lots more. We'll connect our union with the A75, boosting links between Scotland and Northern Ireland. We will fund the Shipley Bypass, the Blyth Relief Road, and deliver 70 other road schemes. We will resurface roads across the country. We'll bring back the Don Valley Line. We will upgrade the energy coastline between Carlisle, Workington and Barrow. Build hundreds of other schemes and keep the £2 bus fare across the whole country.
Right, so locally there's been a bit of a bust up, hasn't there? The government initially said there might be some money, well, there would be some money for a mass transit system in Bristol, which we've been promised, God, over the last 50, 60 years, since they got rid of the trams. Is it going to be a Bristol tram? No, it's not going to happen. Then we got these, what are they called? Metro buses or something, which aren't really anything but just a normal bus. So there's been a spat recently. It's not just all going up north, this money that's been saved from HS2. The Bristol Metro project is in doubt after this political row. This is just on the BBC 20 minutes ago. The future of Bristol's mass transit plan has been thrown into doubt after political leaders failed to agree on how to progress it. At a meeting of the West of England Combined Authority, Metro Mayor Dan Norris vetoed plans to spend £650,000 to explore route options. He took the decision because they include underground sections. The Greens in Bristol, Martin, who look likely to be in charge after the local elections next year, have said they don't want any kind of underground. They think it's a very bad idea. And the main news up on the local Bristol Post website is that the government has deleted £100 million pledge for the Bristol mass transit system. Bristol Live can reveal the Department for Transport said the cash would be spent on Bristol's mass transit underground project, but then removed mention of it from the announcement. The government announced a raft of huge investments that will see mass transit systems introduced in cities across the north of England using the HS2 money. So there's been an enormous and rather childish tug of war here between the Metro Mayor Dan Norris, who doesn't want an underground, and he's obviously friendly with the Greens, who don't, and the current Mayor Marvin Rees, who's most definitely on his way out next May, he's not going to be standing again, who does. So it seems to me that unless these people can sit down and agree on things in a mature fashion, maybe even just down the pub before the meeting, that almost nothing is going to happen here in Bristol again.
Well, I think it's going to be left to the Dan Norris as the Metro Mayor and the Greens as the running the City Council, isn't it? So they'll decide what happens on the bigger issue of HS2, of course. Leaving aside whether it's a good or a bad idea.
Well, I don't want you to do that. I want you to say, do you think it's a good idea or a bad idea to scrap it?
I think it's a bad idea to have it. But that's not what Boris Johnson thinks, because he thinks it should be built, and he thinks it's a betrayal by by Sunak of his promises.
Well, who cares what Boris Johnson thinks? You're fighting last year's battles, Martin, which you've already won, and in rather a silly manner.
Well, I know. You were telling me earlier that he was the guy to run the country.
So no, no, I didn't say that. I said that the Conservatives dropped him, even though he was the most popular leader of the Tory party amongst the public and the voters. Well, the voters, actually, and the Tory members. So it's not the same thing quite, is it? And I know you're always trying to stick silly things like that on me, but, you know, the point is that the Tories have deliberately dropped their most popular leader. But anyway, the point of HS2, I mean, I would totally agree with you. The whole thing was a white elephant from day one, wasn't it? It was Andrew Adonis, wasn't it, under the Labour government, who introduced this. I've not seen him being reeled out to discuss it. And he, in fact, amazingly changed his political party, didn't he? He went from Labour to Tory. Once the Labour were de-elected, and then suddenly Adonis, Lord Adonis, decides, oh, I'm going to be a Tory peer then.
Well, I've got no brief to defend him, and I don't particularly know what party he's in these days. I thought he was still in the Labour Party. Well, I mean, the point about not going on from Birmingham to Manchester is it makes it pretty pointless to build up the stuff from London to Birmingham. And it's therefore becomes a waste of money. Therefore, you might just cancel the whole thing. But the problem with all of these kind of big projects is once you've committed to doing it, you've lost a load of money unless you complete them. And that is the issue. And I think you've definitely going to have it. I mean, Rishi Sunak there was trying to sort of sugar the pill, but there are plenty of Tory Labour switch voters in the north of England who will simply draw the conclusion that all of this stuff was just a come on and they've been had. And I think he's going to find that very hard to, you know, having promised them this and then say he's going to take it away. Andy Burnham, for example, Mayor of Manchester, he said, well, this is outrageous, as he would, because he's Mayor of Manchester.
Yeah, well, anyway, so yeah, he was a Labour Minister of Transport in 2008, who signed off HS2, but then he went off and joined the Tories. He's now the the chairman of the European Movement, which is all of the, and mostly Tories. The president is Lord Heseltine, the vice president is Kenneth Clark. Stephen Dorrell is the previous chairman. So this is basically a group of conservatives who are pro-EU and are still trying to push the whole EU project. That's Lord Adonis, ex-Labour, and he's obviously more loyal and interested in Brussels. But I found it interesting that such a disastrous project and a white elephant as this could be signed off by somebody who's so vehemently pro-EU.
Well, being pro or anti HS2 may have no implications for being pro or anti EU.
All these European style stations being built, many of the companies building all this infrastructure are European companies. And the idea, of course, is that that's the way the EU works. It's a massive cartel where all the infrastructure is built by big French and German conglomerates. Actually, no, by cartels. And that's the way they do things.
Well, I think you're trying. I mean, basically, some people are in favour of HS2 or are very anti EU, and some people are in favour, like Boris Johnson, for example, and some people are in favour of it who are very pro EU.
Well, some are political there for political opportunities, well, exactly. Aren't they? They've got no principles.
Well, I mean, the point
this
is,
money,
that people,
by
people
the way,
have different views about different things.
This money would, by the way, and also, of course, they just take on a view because they think it's win them some sort of political brownie points amongst the movers and shakers. And I'm sure Boris Johnson was one of those. He used to do things, I'm sure he did. But what about all this money that's been spent on HS2 already? I'm reminded of Chris Busby and his looking at the other massive white elephant, which is Hinkley C being built here, tens of billions being spent on that. The idea, apparently, and maybe HS2 is like this too, Martin, maybe you can help us, is that actually the money is really not about delivering a service at the end of the day. It's actually delivering a massively lucrative construction contract for the people who are actually doing the construction are making all the money, and they're going to leave us with something that may or may not work, and they don't really care about whether it does or not.
Yes, and once the contracts have been dished out, then that's definitely the case, isn't it? And of course, with many big projects like this, once you've committed a large amount of finance to it, it then becomes almost irrational to cancel it, because otherwise you've got to write all that money off. I mean, it's quite possible. I mean, I think I saw some senior civil servant saying, well, if it's not going to go on from Birmingham, there's no point building the first bit. because it's just not going to be. It's just going to reduce journey times between London and Birmingham by 15 minutes, and it's not worth the billions that we're spending on.
Well, it's a contract fraud in the beginning because the contractors, the cartel, managed to get some people in the government to sign something which was going to be a disaster. But now, surely the government are going to have to pay the price for breach of contract.
Well, that's right. So, in other words, if you cancel it, you're often spending the money anyway. So, you might. I think what will probably happen, just out of realism, is that they will build the London to Birmingham bit of it. Don't forget, lots of compulsory purchase orders have been put in. All sorts of people have been booted out of their property and so on. And you can't put those people back. And a lot of it has already been built.
I smell the influence of Jacob Rees-Mogg behind all this, because I remember about 2 or 3 years ago, he actually said that look, this is let's stop throwing good money after bad and just cancel HS2, at which point he was quietly moved sideways and told he wasn't supposed to speak to the press anymore.
Well, then, if he's speaking against what is official government policy, then yes, that's what's going to happen to him. He can't be in the cabinet and argue for policies which the government isn't supporting. And of course, he's not.
Well,
anymore.
At the time, there was a debate going on about HS2, about whether they should stop it or not. And he was one of the people who was. I don't think that, you know, it's a constant gag on everything to do with government policies for everybody in the cabinet, is it?
Well, no, it is. That's cabinet. It's all collective cabinet responsibility.
So
Suella Braverman's little speech the other week in America, Sunak was asked whether he agreed with her or not. And he basically had to say, yes, he agreed with her, because otherwise he'd have to sack her. Because that's what this cabinet government is quite...
Like, the cabinet is like one giant super brain, is it?
Well, the idea is joint cabinet responsibility is that we agree in cabinet what we're going to do, then everybody in the cabinet, whether it's Labour or Tory or whatever it is, has got to go out and defend the government's policy. And if they don't agree with it, they've got to resign. That's always been the way things have been run.
Good. Well, I mean, maybe that's why they didn't like what Jacob Rees-Mogg was saying. I don't know if he was actually in the cabinet.
No, well, that's right. If he's outside the cabinet, he can say...
He is allowed to speak. Yeah. Anyway, you mentioned Suella Braverman. She's definitely lining up to be, once Rishi Sunak is booted out, she's going to be one of the people who's in running to take over. So here she is at the top. I mean, there's some amazing... in fact, maybe before we hear from her, we should hear the entertaining speech by Penny Mordaunt, which was an absolutely unbelievable speech, if I can find it. Penny Mordaunt, yeah, let's have a listen to this.
Stand up and fight, because when you stand up and fight, the person beside you stands up and fights. And when our party stands up and fights, the nation stands up and fights. And when our nation stands up and fights, other nations stand up and fight. And they stand up and fight for the things upon which the entire progress of humanity depends. Freedom. That is what conservatives do. That is what this nation does. Have courage. Bring hope. Stand up and fight. Stand up and fight. Thank you, conference.
That's laughing along. I think what happened was somebody, bright spark at Tory Central Office, says she's not very good at writing speeches. Let's let the AI do the speech for her. But the AI bot got stuck.
Well, it sounds like that, doesn't it? I mean, it's just overblown rhetoric, isn't it? How's that supposed to connect to the concerns of ordinary people in this country?
Well, the funny thing was, of course, there was hardly anyone listening to her anyway in the hall. And they weren't. She was stopping, waiting for them to clap.
That's right. It's the sort of speech you've got to make where people are cheering you on and to the rafters and so on. And, of course, there's absolutely no response at all. It's a dead cat bounce, isn't it?
It was absolutely unbelievable. Anyway, the hall was actually packed for Suella Braverman's speech, much more rousing, even though, of course, there's nothing she's going to be doing in the next year to change the situation with the migrants. Here she is having a go at convincing people that maybe she will.
One of the most powerful forces reshaping our world is unprecedented mass migration. The wind of change that carried my own parents across the globe in the 20th century was a mere gust compared to the hurricane that is coming. Because today, the option of moving from a poorer country to a richer one is not just a dream for billions of people. It is an entirely realistic prospect. Every human, every single person has the right to aspire to a better life. As conservatives, that's one of the cornerstones of our philosophy. Indeed, without that dream, I wouldn't be standing before you today. But conservatives are also practical and realistic. Nobody can deny that there are far, far more people in poorer countries who would love to move to Britain than could ever be accommodated. Even if we concreted over the countryside, turned our cities into one vast building site and erected skyscrapers from Eastbourne to Elgin, from Hull to Holyhead, it still wouldn't be enough. Demand will always outstrip supply. I know it, you know it, and the voters know it. This country has been generous in taking in refugees from Afghanistan, from Ukraine, from Syria, from Hong Kong. The decency of the British people cannot be questioned. But they also care deeply about overall numbers. In poll after poll, the British people have been clear. Immigration is already too high. And they know another thing, that the future could bring millions more migrants to these shores, uncontrolled and unmanageable, unless the government they elect next year acts decisively to stop that happening. And we are the only party that will take effective action. Now, I can't pretend that politicians have done a great job of managing immigration for the last 30 years. We were too slow to recognise the scale of the problem, too unwilling to accept that our legal framework needed to be updated. And let's be honest, far too squeamish about being smeared as racist to properly bring order to the chaos. But under Rishi Sunak's leadership, things are changing. We are raising our game. For years, too many overseas students were bringing their dependents here to the UK. So we've changed the rules to ensure that a student visa is not a route for whole families to come and live and work in the UK. When I stood before you at conference last year, we were dealing with a surge of Albanian illegal migrants coming on small boats, over 12,000 in 2022 alone. Fast forward a year, and thanks to the returns deal with Albania that we put in place and changes that we made to our rules, those numbers are now down by 90%.
Well, maybe that's because all the Albanians have already come here, Martin, that want to.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's the problem she's got is that she can go on about how immigration's a problem and refugees are a problem because there's more refugees than ever, because there's more wars than ever. She mentioned their Ukraine, she mentioned their Syria.
You see, you and I will never agree on this, will we? Because, I mean, as far as I see it, this is not just driven by war. Yes, there are some genuine asylum seekers who are fleeing war, but much of it is simple economic migration from Africa across the Mediterranean and into Europe.
All of these people who are claiming asylum under existing UN rules about asylum. Yep. Okay,
and they may not actually have any right to claim asylum, but they do it anyway.
Although, in actual fact, all of the people that have come across on the boats about 60 to 80% of them have been claiming genuine asylum seekers when they've processed the claims. The reason why we're spending £8 million a day on keeping them in hotels is because they can't work and we haven't got any processing of the claims. Because Suella Braverman and Preeti Patel decided to make it as difficult as possible to come here so that we would deter people from coming. The problem they've got is when you're running away from Afghanistan, you are not going to be deterred.
Yeah, but when you're running away from Ethiopia?
Well, yes, there's a war in Ethiopia, Tony. And of course, people say, well, that's nothing to do with us. Yes, it is.
Yes. Yeah, I agree.
One of the things we're doing, we're raising interest rates, aren't we, in the Bank of England and in the Federal Reserve.
It seems to me...
What that's going to do, Tony, there's a UN report that came out this week. Yeah. What it's going to do, it's going to crash the global economies, particularly the poor countries.
When we crash
their economy so we can get rid of our inflation, which is caused by our war with Russia, these people will have nothing in their own countries.
What's really behind this is the destruction of Libya, isn't it?
That's part of it.
That's opened the floodgates, basically.
Absolutely. Because in Libya,
that was David Cameron. It'd be nice to hear a bit about that in her speech.
Well, you're not going to get that from her, are you?
No.
She supported the war in Libya because she supported the Conservative Party, which started the war in Libya. And the war in Libya hasn't ended. And we've started lots of wars which still haven't ended. The collapse of Syria was caused by our intervention in Iraq. And, of course, these places are with an aid worker in Yugoslavia, which is not that far away.
There's nothing whatsoever.
None of these places are far away.
Nothing whatsoever about the biggest problem in Britain, which is arguably housing. Let's have a listen to ITV's report on that.
You wanted to create a housing crisis. You would pretty much do to the letter what we've done in Britain in the last 40 years. You would sell off council houses, more than a million, and you would stop councils from replacing them, from rebuilding them. You would have house price inflation, so people on low and then modest incomes can no longer afford to buy a home, which pushes them into the private rental sector. You then don't regulate or reform the private rental sector to give renters any protection against quick-fire evictions. And then on top of that, you consistently don't build enough houses. So rent goes up, competition goes up, and you end up in situations like this. What we're seeing here, Tom, being no doubt, is years, decades in the making. And I have to say, as you've said, the gap between the problem and the solution is big. Both parties, the Conservative Party and the Labour Party, say housing is a priority. I see little evidence that is the case. Rishi Sunak has his five pledges, not one of them is on housing. Keir Starmer has his five pledges, none of them are on housing. There's little detail in Labour's plan. Many people say what is needed here is a kind of 1950s-style response, a mass house building across the country. That is not being proposed by either party. This problem is not a housing crisis, it's a housing emergency, and we're seeing the working poor becoming the working homeless in this country.
Isn't that interesting? And the fact is that this is the main one of the, you know, what people spend most of their money on in their entire lives is housing, and yet neither of the parties are interested in doing anything about it. Martin, we're on the sort of cusp between the Tory Party conference this week and next week's Labour conference. But are we going to hear anything from Labour? Do you think?
Not enough, for sure. I mean, that analysis is correct. The problem is that people who have on the housing ladder, while the property market is expanding, it's free money for them. And therefore, they're quite unwilling to change that because it's free money. I mean, basically, if you leave university with hardly any debt because you're relatively well off, you can get on the housing ladder, and that's free money coming into
you. It's not money coming into you. It's an asset which you can then... It's asset-rich, cash-poor. You know, you may not... Actually, you may have a house which is worth money, but you can't necessarily realise that asset.
Well, that's not necessarily the case because you can use it as
I would rather people did have an asset. You know, that's great to people that
have
a house.
I know, but it's irrational.
You seem to think that it's great for everyone to be renting. That's actually what the banks want.
It's not rational for people to make... It's what the basic theory of economic rent in textbooks going back to the 19th century. If people can make more money from investing in houses than they can from investing in business, your small business and small and medium enterprises are starved of capital.
Absolutely right. I agree with you.
And
yeah,
that's exactly
and that's
why
happening.
We run it like this. What we do in this country is people make money through bricks and mortar,
and we don't have an economy. You'd have a very simple system, couldn't you, where people are not allowed to own more than one house. Very
you
simple.
Yes, you could indeed. Yeah. I mean, in New Zealand...
The idea that people are buying houses just as an investment rather than to live in is one of the reasons we've got so much empty property. property, derelict land.
That's
We've
right.
got a massive amount of derelict
That's
land
right.
in St. Paul's here.
There's plenty,
it's been
there's,
empty
there's
for the
plenty
last,
of big houses that have got loads of room
the,
in them.
Empty for the last 10 years. Even though it's right in the centre of St. Paul's, it seems to me, I mean, this is what we were, they were discussing at Coomber, that there's this attempt to bring up the value of the land. And then once the value of the land has been brought up, gentrification in St. Paul's here in Bristol, then they'll build. And well, then they'll sell them at inflated prices.
Well, what's happening in London is that primary schools are closing because locals who've lived there all their lives and their grandparents were born in London cannot afford to live there, and they literally got to leave. And Bristol is further back than that, but that's what's happening.
It will be happening here. Words, it's happening here already. Yes, in fact, right. people are being sent out to Newport. I was chatting to someone the other day who said, well, my kids can't afford to buy a house in Bristol. So they, although they work here, they've gone on, they're living in Newport now.
Yes, and of course, this process, this is, it's not just a British phenomenon, but it's a particularly British phenomenon compared, for example, to Germany, where there's a much bigger private rental sector under regulation.
It's partly because we were the first, I suppose, to come out of industrialisation, or one of the first countries to deindustrialise, and we haven't actually found out what to do.
Well, we deindustrialised because precisely
what
because
we're
going to
do now. We're not an industrial power, so I'll tell you what, let's just try and speculate on the property market. Anyway, we're going to go and have a look at
the speculation
labor.
On the property market has led to the deindustrialisation. They're two linked things.
Oh, I think it's the other way around. Deindustrialisation
is
linked
to property,
just property.
This is the point I was making earlier. If you have people being able to make money out of the property market, they don't go into business to make money. Banks don't lend to businesses in this country.
Well, you know what they say,
they lend on real estate.
They say safe as houses. Anyway, let's go and have a look at the Labour Party conference. And this is one speech you won't be hearing this year.
Comrades, we are coming to this conference asking for your support. We believe, as a constituent part of the Labour Party, we're entitled to ask for that support after 7 months not fighting for the National Union of Mine Workers, not fighting for the jobs of miners, but fighting against the whole concept of this government's economic policy, which is designed to destroy jobs and to wreak havoc amongst the British Labour and trade union movement. We've challenged the whole basic concept of this Conservative government's philosophy. I reject the right of any employer to turn round and destroy the jobs of miners or any other workers. We should not stand aside when faced with the fact that communities may be laid desolate as a result of the economic philosophy either of this government or an employer or both. As we go into the 8th month of this dispute, there's one thing coming through loud and clear. The miners' union are winning this fight, and they're not only winning it for miners, they're winning it for you in the entire labour and trade union movement. There can be no doubt about the logic of our case. If logic, eloquence and justice had been the hallmark of what should have been done, we would have won this case months ago. But we've got to overcome a government whose bloody-mindedness has made thousands and thousands of our people face a situation that they've not faced since 1926. We've got food kitchens established in every village. We've had 3,000 of our people injured on picket lines. We've had 5 of our people killed as they fight for the right to work. For God's sake, colleagues, give support to our resolution and to the statement of the NEC, and take us with you and with the NUM on the way to victory.
Well, actually, it wasn't the miners' union that won. It wasn't victory event eventually, but that's not the sort of conference speech we're going to be hearing at Labour this time. That was, you want to guess what year that was?
Well, it'd be 1984, wouldn't it?
Completely right, yes, 1984. And I just find it amazing, listening back to that, that we've now got a whole kind of apparent consensus, one of these fake consensuses on the left, that coal is evil, you know, after that strike.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of water has flowed under a lot of bridges since then.
How quickly we forget, you know, this was an enormous attempt to smash.
Well, I mean, the Labour conferences still had, there were still places where policy was made. That's long gone. I mean, basically, the Labour conference in Liverpool will be managed from the top by the party managers. They will parade this new MP that's just been elected in Scotland, and everybody will dutifully cheer the glorious leader as he promises to be the best Conservative leader the country has ever had, because that's what Keir Starmer is. He would have been, in the 1970s or in the 1980s, he would have been a moderate Conservative. But now he's the... And, of course, he thinks that's a positive thing. He doesn't see that as a negative thing. He thinks what he's done is he's made the Labour Party electable, he's made it mainstream, he's made it acceptable to the boss class, as Arthur Scargill would call them, and he's not repentant about that at all. He thinks it's a good thing that he's pursuing those goals. We'll see how it turns out.
Some other stories this week. Excess deaths in 2022 were amongst the worst in 50 years. This is basic stats. Lots of people are dying. Why is that, Martin?
Well, I think there's an interest. I don't follow John Campbell's stuff.
It's not just John Campbell.
But I mean, he has been looking into all of this.
9% more than in 2019.
Yes. Well, I mean, there's something going on, isn't there? And we need to know what it is. There's all sorts of things that
did
maybe
you see, by the way, the coach crash that happened, I think it was actually last Friday, the same day our show was on, up in Merseyside. Initially, the police Merseyside press office put out lying reports saying that another car was involved. As it's turned out afterwards, actually the 40-year-old driver suffered a medical episode at the wheel and turned the coach over and killed one of the kids who were on there.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to comment on that because that's
one of the stats. You know, yes. What happened there?
Well, I'll just make this point, Tony. The stats are very clear that most countries, developing world countries, have had an increasing life expectancy. But since the Tories came to power after the 2008 crash, life expectancy in this country has gone down.
It's the Tories, not the Jabs, the Tories.
It could be both, Tony, couldn't it? I'm not saying it's one or the other. I'm just saying austerity kills people. It certainly does.
Psychotic Star Wars fan encouraged to kill the Queen by an AI chatbot has been jailed for 9 years. I don't know what kind of sentence the AI chatbot has got.
Well, I don't quite understand what the point about is. I mean, what's happened?
He's a
here?
Star Wars fan, and yeah. he was encouraged to kill the Queen by an AI chatbot, allegedly. He's just been put in jail for 9 years. So he was a self-styled assassin who was encouraged by an AI chatbot to break into Windsor Castle with a loaded crossbow, and he's been locked up now for 9 years. But chatbot telling him to kill the Queen.
Well, it may be that he's got mental health issues. That's what it sounds like to me.
Well, they're very useful, these people, isn't it? Maybe people with mental health issues can just be put in a room with an AI chatbot and then programmed to do an MK Ultra assassination.
Well, we know that that's what goes on, Tony. And it's not that, it's not just the Queen that ends up getting killed, is it?
Anyway, the idea is if he is insane, surely he shouldn't have to do a prison sentence.
Well, I don't know the details of this case, but it strikes me that if he's criminally insane, he should be locked up. But that doesn't mean that it's...
But lots of people who are insane are not locked up anymore, are they?
Well...
The idea is let everyone run loose, care in the community.
Yes, and that's Margaret Thatcher bringing it back to the 1980s. That was one of her great
major,
big ideas.
Major, actually, it was care in the community in the major years in the 90s.
Yes.
I remember Virginia Bottomley rolling that whole thing out, so... I mean, it seems that... would you want to just say something about the use of people with mental illness? Because this is, you know, the idea that the chatbot that has managed to persuade this guy to go and kill somebody, obviously that is incitement to crime. The AI chatbot...
you can't sentence an AI chatbot.
Who programmed it to do that?
Well, this is the problem with all of this stuff, isn't it?
Well, maybe these things should be totally banned and criminalised until someone can guarantee that they're not going to incite you to go and kill someone.
AI is not going to be banned and criminalised while it's a crucial element of war fighting, which is what it's become. The military
wants AI. So is this a bit of kind of... you think maybe a kind of spin-off from military experiments? Absolutely.
The reason why AI and 5G and all these other things are not going to be banned is because we're in World War III. And look at all the electronic warfare stuff that's going on in the Ukraine. Both sides are determined to dominate the electronic warfare battlefield. AI is a part of that. And that's why there isn't going to be a civilized discussion about what we should or shouldn't do with AI. Because it's a life and death battlefield thing. And like a lot of other things, we're now getting into a catastrophic breakdown of various systems that we live under. Because we've spent years and years and years sawing on the branch we're sitting on.
You know, you and I know Silky Carlo, a fantastic lady that runs something called Big Brother Watch. They are responding to the government's plans this week to create a giant facial recognition database out of our passport photos. Now, the idea is that you give your passport photo for the use just of your passport, but this all goes on to some massive database that apparently the Foreign Office, who run the passport system, now want to flog it off.
To whom?
Well, to people that want to use facial recognition.
Well, I don't think that's acceptable at all. Facial recognition may be justified by the state to control, you know, criminals and so forth, but it certainly shouldn't be in the hands of any kind of private organisation whatsoever, especially if you've given it to a state organisation for a specified purpose. Nobody else should have access to it.
45 million of us with passports who gave our images for travel purposes without any kind of consent or the ability to object, to be part of secret police lineups, to scan the population's photos with highly inaccurate facial recognition technology. And treat us, I remember seeing once the facial recognition, and I feel a bit like this because I've got a bit of a short haircut at the moment and quite a long, well, reasonably long beard. And what can often happen is if a facial recognition bot takes my face picture, it will put my beard on top of my head and it will turn my head upside down and try and recognise that. But there's all sorts of problems with this software. To scan the population's photos with this inaccurate, as I just pointed out, facial recognition technology and treat us all as suspects. So anyway, good old Silky's doing something about that. I'll put a link up to their little campaign on the stopping of that, and they have got some sort of petition going on it. So this is exactly the sort of thing that we accuse China of doing, isn't it? And we're doing it. We're taking the a sacrosanct database of passports, photos, and we're saying, okay, you know, let's just give it all to the cops or whoever else wants it. In fact, they're selling it. That's what they're doing.
Well, if they're selling it, that really is unacceptable. I think what you'll find in China is they're quite straight up and upfront about it. Everybody carries their documents, electronic or otherwise. People are identified by the state, and it's a communist country. That's what they do, and that's how it works.
We did talk about housing a bit, but I'd like just like to revisit that quickly. House prices, this is Money, is talking about them this week, falling £14,500 in the past year, Nationwide says. So in the year to September, the average price of houses is falling 5.3%. So just in September, they fell 1,300. So obviously, that's in a, just in September, I mean, that's a much bigger fall over the whole year. But so maybe something up to 7, 8, 9% in a year falling. So we've got a bizarre situation where they've just announced that rents are at an all-time high in London. And yet house prices are falling. So what's going on?
Well, what's happening is a property crash, because it's baked in since the 2008 crash, and the attempts to try and deal with that by printing money and propping up the banking system and the property market. Ultimately, you run out of road and things start to go down the drain. And when they do start going down the drain, it's hard to stop them going down the drain because it's a cumulative process. And you can't cut you see, if the Tories come win the next election, most unlikely, and they try and cut public expenditure to deal with the crisis, that will have the same effect as Osborne's austerity. It'll kill a lot of people, but it also will kill the economy. We're staring down the barrel of a gun here. In the whole of Europe, Europe is about to be completely deindustrialised and completely socially destabilised so that the Americans can cling on to their last few years of global power.
Well, I'm not so sure they will.
I don't think they will, no. But of course, the disorderly wind-up of the American empire could be extremely unpleasant to live through.
I was down to see Dartmoor, David Halpin, this week. He's the I find him a fantastic and fascinating guy. He's the person who, not totally single-handedly, but he fearlessly challenged this idea that Dr. David Kelly had committed suicide and proved, in no uncertain terms, that it couldn't possibly have committed suicide by slashing his wrist, because there was nowhere near enough blood around it anyway. Slashing your wrists is very unlikely to cause you to die, because your body heals up before you bleed out. And so David Halpin has made it very important. I mean, just to remind us about this bizarre death of Kelly, Martin, he was a very interesting character, wasn't he? He wasn't just involved in the weapons of mass destruction that they were talking about in Iraq, he was involved in nuclear weapons too, wasn't he?
Yes, well, I don't know the full details of everything he was involved in, but he was definitely an expert in those fields.
He was like the expert, basically. Yeah. And he, in fact, he flew over, didn't he, to South Africa with David Cameron to do some sort of nuclear deal too.
Yes, that's right. They were. This was the decommissioning of South Africa's nuclear weapons in the 1980s. And the deal was done with, I've forgotten the name of the company now run by the MI6 guy. It'll come to my mind in a minute because you've...
Astra.
That's right. Astra.
Fireworks.
Astra was... There were nine warheads. There were 10 originally, but one of them had been exploded over the South Atlantic as a test. There were nine warheads. Six of them went to the United States and were decommissioned in Dayton, Ohio. Four of them, or three of them, went to Britain, but they didn't go directly to Britain. They were sold to Astra Holdings, which was run by an MI6 officer whose name, again, I've forgotten because it was sprung this on me. And then they were basically, they disappeared. And Kelly knew all about this stuff because him and David Cameron had been the people who went over there to do the deal.
And this was used to raise money for an election.
Yes, it was used to raise money for the Conservative Party.
Amazing, isn't it?
And anyway, we've got all this information from people in the know.
I think it's amazing how it's a bit like I actually like the assassination of Lord Mountbatten. You do wonder, I mean, he was very much involved in this whole business of the Fourth Reich, setting that up after World War II by getting Martin Bormann out of Nazi Germany at the end of the Second World War and then squirreling him away. And he knew all about that in South America, and he was very, very close to now King Charles when he was growing up. But when he was killed by the IRA, supposedly, I mean, there might be other reasons why they wanted him. Anybody who's involved in these dirty, dodgy stuff, what they're doing, of course, is they're opening themselves up to possible assassination too. And David Halpin was talking to me this week about Lawrence of Arabia and how he believes he's discovered the details about his assassination just before the Second World War. Now, Lawrence of Arabia, Martin, was involved very much with the Arabs, wasn't he, in trying to stop German railways and push between the wars, mainly, and the time of the First World War, to push British power in the Middle East. So can you just say something before we hear from David, a little bit about who T.E. Lawrence of Arabia was?
Well, he was an academic, really, and he was an archaeologist. And when war broke out, he was drafted into the...
This is the First World War.
This is the First World War. And if you read The Seven Pillars of Wisdom, which is his autobiography, it's, you know, obviously it's very much about him. He was very much a self-publicist. He worked with the Arabs to set up a rebellion against Ottoman rule. And he promised Faisal, who was the Sharif of Mecca, that if the Arabs participated in rebellion against Ottoman rule, then there would be an Arab state set up, which would, basically be allowed, be an independent political force in the world. He claimed subsequently not to know about the MacMahon Agreement, which had been made by another British official with the Zionist lobby to set up the State of Israel. And also, he claimed he didn't know about the Sykes-Picot Agreement between the British and the Americans, not the Americans, the British and the French, to carve up the Middle East. So the Arabs basically fought on the Allied side in World War One, only to find that what they'd been promised for taking all of those risks, essentially an independent state, was taken off them because the French and the British basically carved it up between them. And on top of that, cherry on the cake, they promised the Zionist state in Israel.
Well, this is the main point, isn't it? He was a crucial part in actually allowing that.
Well, yes,
to happen.
So in other words, in later life, he said that he felt bad about the way the Arabs had been betrayed.
But he didn't get much of a chance to say that because he was assassinated. Let's have a listen now to David Halpin.
We visited the cottage of T.E. Lawrence. The National Trust own it, or hang under trust, and it was extraordinary. Had to book in every 20 minutes, groups of about seven or eight. Excellent fellow in charge and a good guide. The next day we went to Hardy's cottage at Bockhampton. But when I went into Lawrence's little cottage, which is superbly fitted up by Lawrence himself, I felt the aura of Lawrence, and I know that he was assassinated. I know he was. And I know now why he was assassinated. T. Lawrence was a illegitimate son of some Sir somebody, I forget now his title or his name, but he's one of about seven children that this man had, I think was a housemaid or someone similar to that, actually. He was known to be illegitimate, and his father had some interest in him and the other children that he fathered. But Lawrence obviously had a high intellect. He got to Cambridge, or Oxford, I think Cambridge, actually, and he studied archaeology. And he was able to read Egyptian script, that sort of thing. And his first years as a young adult was in archaeology. And then, of course, he became involved with the army. And he was critical in the First World War in what we now call the Middle East.
It was at the time the Ottoman Empire, of course.
Yes, of course, the Ottoman Empire. And we, of course, were after the oil in Iran, and we were after installing a garrison, i.e. Israel, in the Middle East, to make sure that the Suez Canal was kept patent for the Raj, and the oil in the Persian Gulf, and the rest of it. No doubt geologists then were finding that there was oil in Saudi Arabia and the Oman, I forget, you know, how many places there were finding oil.
The place in the world that you had to be, because you're on the pivot of the three continents, Europe, yes. Africa and Asia.
Yes, exactly. The pivot, good point. And of course, it's a good reminder, that's where mankind came from. You know, they came from the Rift Valley, and then it migrated upwards across the Middle Eastern bridge into Europe and changed their skin colour eventually by evolution. But when I went into this room of this little cottage of Lawrence, he was obviously a very ascetic man, very intelligent, but he was also a universalist. That's what I know. This man had respect from the Arab guerrillas that he worked with. And he was crucial, because what they built, or the Germans were building with the Turks, a Berlin to Baghdad railway. I didn't know about that. But they were blowing it up, the guerrillas. They were very... I know a lot of Arab people now. They tend to be compulsive and passionate. And I can just imagine that some young Arabs, perhaps Bedouin, in fact they were Bedouin, mostly in origin, they were very brave, they were very courageous, they didn't mind losing their lives for Allah. And Lawrence, with these men, blew up the trains. And that was crucial in towards the defeat of the Ottoman Empire with German help in the Middle East in the Second World War.
So now, for anyone that hasn't worked it out so far, we're talking about Lawrence of Arabia.
Lawrence of Arabia, as so-called. But the story is this, and this is, in fact, when I think about it, what I talk about, Tony, is the radix, the root. And I use as a metaphor, for most people, and I include many doctors that I'm afraid to say, most people have the pond skater mentality. They do not look down into the depths. They are preyed upon, and they prey. I don't mean P-R-A-Y, I mean P-R-E-Y. They prey upon other creatures in the pond. They're darting around as you see them, suspended on surface tension. But that is their characteristic. They are suspended on surface tension. So you see...
They only lead two-dimensional lives.
Two-dimensional lives. And a lot of them are university graduates who are up their arses. And what I find so reassuring is my conversations with what I call the common woman and man, the people who put the drains in or plaster the walls or, like now, fixing our chimney. These people know what's going on. And the Devonians are able to look into the eyes of people, and they know the shysters at sight. They know it. Now, the people you find in the cities, particularly the graduate variety, can't do that. They have no idea. They read the papers, the Guardian, the Grudian, and the Times and the Telegraph, and they think that is the truth. It shows you how two-dimensional they are. But getting back to Lawrence, my dad who encouraged me, my sister Mary, 16 months younger, and perhaps my two brothers, Michael and Peter, not so sure about the younger, but he encouraged us to think independently, and he cared about things. He opposed the EU. He went round with his amplifier. He was an electronic engineer, self-taught, and he went round his amplifier in Swanage, near where they lived, and he went round giving his own views about joining the common market. He was with Tony Benn on that, and a very good man from New Zealand called Gould, and I think someone else.
Brian Gould.
Yeah. Brian Gould, that's right. And, of course, the blood man, Enoch Powell. He was also anti-EU.
Well, but listen, there were loads and loads of them. And, of course, there always have been in the Conservative Party. Another one was very articulate. It was Peter Shaw in the Labour Party.
And you should see his speech at Oxford Union. If anyone hasn't seen that, Google the Oxford Union speech by Peter Shaw. He speaks without hardly a note, and he speaks with eloquence which we've never seen repeated since.
Total lack of statesmen around today.
But smirking in the gallery in that Oxford debate was Heath. He was smirking. There was Barbara Castle there, and also the Liberal leader, Thorpe. Thorpe, with his history. Awful people. Terrible people.
So anyway, how does this link up with Lawrence of Arabia?
Sorry, I digress as usual. I've got too much in me, and I remember things rather easily. My father, when he was living in Swanage, in Sutton, near Swanage, he became friendly with a man called War, W-A-R-R. In fact, he taught Sue in about 1956 how to drive. He was a driving instructor. He told my father this story, and it's a very important story. I told it to the fellow who was at T. E. Lawrence's cottage, and he just took it as a national trust. He couldn't respond, of course. But War said, I presume that he was a chauffeur before the war, Second World War. He was driving from Winchester to London, and anyone who knows that road before there was a motorway, it goes uphill and downhill, probably Roman Road, but you can see sometimes about 3 or 4 miles ahead. He said that a motorbike with a pillion up overtook his vehicle, and he then saw a black limousine. I'm telling the words my father told me from Mr. War, a black limousine coming from the opposite direction, veer across the road and smash into the motorcycle. And there were two bodies, I think that's why I was told that, on the tarmac. What was interesting, and I think helps to clinch the truth of this, is that there were then police in the scene. Now, we're thinking about Winchester, 1935. You would be lucky to have a copper on a bike 5 miles away. So that, I think, the story may be truthful. And it's been repeated. There was a film made by about 5 years ago, actually. Now, I think I wrote to the fellow who produced it. It was called, they told me this, actually, at the cottage. It was called Lawrence After Arabia. That was the name of the film. They told me it was shown locally, but it hasn't been shown generally. No surprise there. We are in verboten Britain.
So who was on the motorbike?
We don't know. But War believes that it was Lawrence with his Batman or similar on the pillion.
That's Dr. David Halpin there, speaking to me earlier this week about the assassination, or presumed assassination, likely assassination, obvious assassination, of Lawrence of Arabia. Fascinating as to why. The film is available. I think it's on a DVD or whatever. It's called A Dangerous Man, Lawrence After Arabia, made in 1990, a television film. What do you think about David's suggestion there that locally, where he lived, people kind of knew he'd been assassinated, and the idea was to get him out of the way? We didn't want him rocking the boat during World War II, and certainly not around the time of the creation of the Israeli state.
Well, the state of Israel in the 1940s. Yes, well, I mean, it's quite feasible. We know that the state kills people. You know, did they kill this person? Well, it's quite possible. I'm not going to rule it out, but there's no point me saying that I know they did, because I don't. I haven't got enough information.
But, I mean, what about the sort of the political weight in this equation, the kind of circumstantial evidence?
Well, I mean, you've got to think of means, motive, and opportunity, haven't you? So, it's quite likely that Lawrence's view... Lawrence was definitely alienated from the establishment at the end of the First World War, because he felt that he'd been made to look like a liar and a fool, because he promised the Sharif of Mecca and various other people, Abu Taib and all the other people that he used to be working with. Incidentally, coming back to a matter of fact about blowing up railway lines, they were not blowing up the Berlin to Baghdad railway. They were fighting in what is now Saudi Arabia, and that's not on the way between Berlin and Baghdad.
The idea of the Arab nations being one did kind of surface, didn't it, after the war?
Well,
in pan-Arabism, and it's been a brilliant, by the way, there's a brilliant series at the moment on Al Jazeera all about the October War, and this whole idea of, you know, Syria, Palestine, Egypt all fighting together to try to get the Israelis back into the box, into the actual legal borders that they had. But this whole idea of pan-Arabism was very big after the war, wasn't it? And, I mean,
it was,
as you say, during.
Yeah. Big in the World War One itself. What Britain, through Lawrence, were promising the Arab insurgents was that if they joined against the Muslim power of Ottoman Turkey with the British, that they would get a state, an Arab state, which would cover most of what is now the Middle East, majority Arab areas. But what happened, it happened at the end of the war, is that the British and the French, under the Sykes-Picot Agreement, carved up the Middle East. They gave the Sharif of Mecca Saudi Arabia. They gave...
Look, in a nutshell, let's just try to cut to the chase here, because they conned Lawrence, didn't they, into thinking one thing, and actually they just simply used him as a tool. And he would have been absolutely livid.
That's right.
If he'd have lived to see what happened.
He wasn't happy, because he'd been made to look as if he'd based... Because he actually believed in the Arab cause, which is why they believed in him. And then, of course, he felt that he'd been lied to by the British establishment about the whole thing.
It's a bit like Princess Diana. They didn't want him spending years talking to the press and making a big fuss about the way he'd been mistreated. Anyway, we're going to have a break now. We'll be talking to Mike Harris over in the US about much of the developments, particularly with Donald Trump this week, after the break.
We sing a hymn in praise of St. Aldhelm. With the saints whose stories stir us, Lord, we gather in your name.
New Testament reading comes from the first letter to Timothy, the 6th chapter, beginning at the 11th verse. But as for you, man of God, pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, endurance, gentleness. Fight the good fight of the faith. Take hold of the eternal life to which you were called, and for which you made the good confession in the presence of many witnesses. In the presence of God, who gives life to all things, and of Christ Jesus, who in his testimony before Pontius Pilate made the good confession, I charge you to keep the commandment without spot or blame, until the manifestation of our Lord Jesus Christ, which he will bring about at the right time. He who is the blessed and only Sovereign, the King of kings and Lord of lords. It is he alone who has immortality and dwells in unapproachable light. No one has ever seen or can see. To him be honor and eternal dominion. Amen. As for those who in the present age are rich, command them not to be haughty or to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but rather on God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. They are to do good, to be rich in good works, generous, and ready to share, thus storing up for themselves the treasure of a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of the life that really is life. Here ends the second lesson.
You gave me nothing, this can save me.
So that was the ABBA and SOS there from 1975. Interesting, they started off, didn't they? I think it was 74 with Waterloo, and some really good songs. If you look at their discography, it kind of slowly but surely peters out around about 1980, but late 70s, fantastic bunch. So, and before that, we heard a clip from Choral Evensong. Actually, that hymn was from last week's Choral Evensong, which was, dare I say, hacked. Well, it may not have been hacked. It may have been a genuine technical error. The BBC couldn't keep their live link, internet link, or whatever it was, between Broadcasting House and Greenwich going. I mean, God knows how they can manage to fail there. So maybe it was hacked. Who knows? But anyway, so they started off Choral Evensong on Wednesday, 3 o'clock on Radio 3, and it just got conked out. So they had to have a bit of a panic. And but anyway, that was a very nice hymn, and that was part of the replacement for what was actually from the Royal Naval College in Greenwich, I think, that was sent to us. But anyway, so welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. And I hope I'm joined on the line now from the United States by Mike Harris. Mike, are you there?
I'm well, Tony. How are you, sir?
Yeah, very well, Mike. And I think we're going to have to start by talking a bit about Donald Trump, aren't we? What's been going on this week in New York City?
Well, that is an interesting clown show.
Well, why do you say a clown show? It's actually deadly serious, isn't it? You've got, you know, a potential president pointing out that the clerk in the Supreme Court there is having a relationship of some kind, maybe sexual, maybe it's not. But anyway, quite an important person. That is to say, the majority leader in the Senate for the Democrat Party. Now, that does rather should recuse her from any kind of role in prosecuting Donald Trump, one would have thought.
Well, if that allegation is true, yes, it should. She should recuse herself, or at least be excluded from participating in anything relating to Donald Trump at all, because of the obvious political opposition that Schumer has towards Trump and the statements that Schumer has made, which have been so, you know, vicious against Donald Trump. I mean, he's really been a tough critic. And not always very fair or unbiased, not statesmanlike at all, Mr. Schumer.
So, what's your assessment of it? Do you think it's true there is a relationship? I know he tweeted, Donald Trump tweeted, didn't he? I think it was a tweet that was then taken down because the court ordered him to. You're not allowed to say this. It was a picture of Alison Greenfield along with Chuck Schumer with their arms around each other, having a nice little chit chat, and they're obviously pally, very close. What's your assessment of the truth of these allegations? Because if they are true, this is extremely dodgy for the judge to be then saying you're not allowed to talk about it.
Well, you're not allowed to say it, even if it is true. that's a state of censorship here in the United States. We have gone far from being the land of the free and the home of the brave. We're no longer free, and I don't see much bravery anymore either. But you know, Donald Trump is getting a raw deal across the board. These four sets of litigation, 91 felony charges against him, indictments. This is absurd. You know, he's done really nothing wrong in this particular trial that he's in. It was a victimless, if it was a crime, it was a victimless crime. All the banks were repaid. All the banks made a profit off of these transactions. And so where no harm, no foul. Where was the crime committed if there was a crime? Well, and I think this whole thing is going to fall apart. I truly do.
Well, you mean the case?
Yeah, the case. If not in this court, certainly in the appeals court it should. But you know, Trump is not a coward. He'll take this thing all the way to the United States Supreme Court if the New York courts are that corrupt.
Anyway, let's have a listen to Donald Trump himself speaking about this lady that no one's allowed to mention, the clerk to the court called Alison Greenfield.
This is a continuation of the single greatest witch hunt of all time. We have a rogue judge who rules that properties are worth a tiny fraction, 1/100, a tiny fraction of what they actually are. We have a racist attorney general who's a horror show, who ran on the basis that she was going to get Trump before she even knew anything about me. She used this to run for governor. She failed in her attempt to run for governor. She had virtually no polling. She came back and she said, well, now I'll go back to get Trump again. And this is what we have. It's a scam. It's a sham. Just so you know, my financial statements are phenomenal. They are actually less in terms of the numbers used than the actual net worth. The actual net worth is substantially more. No bank was affected. No bank was hurt. They don't even know why they have to be involved. And they've so testified. They can't believe that they're involved because they were paid back on time. There were no defaults. There were no problems. And it was like a perfect client. In the meantime, people are being murdered all over the sidewalks of New York. There was no victim here. The banks were represented by the best, biggest, most prestigious law firms in the state of New York, actually in the country. Some of the biggest and best law firms, in all cases, the biggest and best law firms. That's who represented them. The banks got back their money. Again, there was never a default. There was never a problem. Everything was perfect. There was no crime. The crime is against me because we have a corrupt district attorney, but we have a corrupt attorney general. And it all comes down from the DOJ. They're totally coordinated. It's in Washington because I'm leading. I'm the leading candidate. I'm leading Biden by 10 points. And I'm leading the Republicans by 50 and 60 points. That's pretty much, they say, over. I never accept that, but they say it's over. This has to do with election interference, plain and simple. They're trying to damage me so that I don't do as well as I'm doing in the election. Our country's gone to hell. A country that's in decline, serious decline. We have a man running our country who has no clue, doesn't know what he's doing, and you know it better than anybody because you have to cover him. What they've done with open borders, what they've done with interest rates and taxes, it's a disgrace. So what we have here is an attempt to hurt me in an election. It's an attempt to hurt me in an election. This never happened before, where President of the United States leaves office and gets indicted. And the reason I got indicted was that I ran. If I didn't run, I'd be sitting right now at a beach like Biden does every time, even though he's supposed to be working. So very simply put, it's a witch hunt. It's a disgrace. We have a corrupt attorney general in this state. You see how she does. This trial was railroaded and fast-tracked. This trial could have been brought years ago, but they waited till I was right in the middle of my campaign. The same with other trials and indictments. It's all run by DOJ, which is corrupt in Washington. Everything goes through them. They're all corrupt people. Frankly, our country is corrupt. And that's one of the reasons I'm running. We're going to straighten it out.
Well, he's going to try, maybe, if he gets a chance to run. Welcome back, Mike. Yeah, I mean, he's talking about a witch hunt here, the biggest witch hunt of all time. Martin thinks that's a bit of an exaggeration, but, you know, obviously it is quite important who is and who is not allowed to run the empire.
Well, it is. The banking money powers want to stay in control. And we, for a long time in the United States, have had our leadership selected, not elected. And what surprised them when Donald Trump won in 2016 is they already had the fix in for Hillary Clinton. They gave her 4% extra votes than she actually garnered, thinking that would be enough to push her over
the top. Okay, so how did they do that?
Oh, these Dominion electronic voting machines. It's quite simple.
Well, hang on. You can't say that because Fox News lost a case against them.
Well, Fox News folded on a case. They didn't lose. They reached an
out-of-court
settlement.
That's true. Absolutely true.
Fox News folded. There was never discovery. There was never a trial on that. And so if you've ever been to a casino and, you know, if it's a slow night, they'll dial up how many people are winning and how much they're winning. And then they get the place all frothy and everybody's winning and having a good time. Then they dial it back so that they get all the money back that they lent out for a period of time. It's the same thing with these Dominion voting machines. They can adjust them on the fly as to who's going to win, which district, which jurisdiction, which precinct down to that level. And just for some background, at one time in my life, I was a precinct committee captain for the Republican Party. At another time, I was the finance chairman for the Republican Party, and I was also a candidate for governor of the state of Arizona. And I just got clobbered. I got to tell you on that one. But I've got some political experience here, so I'm very familiar with these things. And the use of COVID as a cover story for the mail-in ballots that were clearly fraudulent, the halting of the election process, the counting process, which had never been done in history, and on all of the battleground states, and then suddenly it goes from Donald Trump being up by 800,000 votes to losing by 12,000. It's just absurd, and anybody with an IQ over room temperature can see what's happened here, what's going on.
Martin, do you want to give us your view? Because, I mean, it could be simply be sour grapes from Donald Trump here. Maybe these prosecutions are perfectly valid.
Well, obviously, this is a very contested area, and there's lots of allegations being made around by all sides. Obviously, I don't agree with the prosecution of Donald Trump. It's an idiotic strategy by the deep state.
What you're implying is that it's a corrupt trial, then?
Well, I generally tend to agree with that. What I would say is this. The electoral college system in the United States clearly gives the possibility that people with less votes end up being the president. That is not the case in the democratic situation in modern Russia. Putin is going to go to the presidential election there next March, and he's going to walk it. He's going to get 80% plus. That doesn't happen in the US. Quite frequently, whoever wins has got less votes because of the electoral college system, has got less votes than the people who did win. And that's a bug, not a that's a feature, not a bug. Okay. And that's a problem when you're at war with a country which is more democratic than you are.
Well, we'll also be talking a bit about Ukraine in a minute, but let's go back to Trump's press conference and here, where he explains a bit about this. He's been prosecuted for undervaluing his assets, and here he is trying to explain that he didn't do that at all, and why it is that he believes, anyway, that the court has already found, basically, almost entirely in his favour, but that this judge is trying to keep the court case going for political reasons.
They have one property that's worth anywhere from 50 to 100 times what this judge put down as a value. Put down a value, $18 million, and the property's probably worth, could be anywhere from 50 to 100 times more than that. And a lot of those numbers could even be low. We have other properties, the same thing. So he devalued everything. I didn't even put in my best asset, which is the brand, in terms of value. Coca-Cola, take a look at their value. They have a value. The value of their brand is more than everything else put together. My brand is extremely valuable. I didn't even use it in my financial statement. If I wanted to build up a financial statement, I would have built it up by using brand in addition to everything else. We have the greatest properties. We have among the greatest properties in the world, and I have to go through this for political reasons. This judge is a politician. He comes out of the clubs. He's running unopposed. The reason he's unopposed is because he's getting Trump. They always run opposed. He's getting Trump. The bosses say, don't run against this guy. He's doing great. He's getting Trump. But he overplayed his hand, and he should be investigated for what he's done. What he did in undervaluing these properties is a disgrace to our nation. This shouldn't be a case. One other thing. We have a clause in the contract which tells, essentially, buyer beware. The contract is very, very, if you take a look and you speak to the banks, and you will, I hope you speak to the banks, because the banks got paid in full. I hope you speak to the banks. But we have a clause in the contract. It's like a buyer beware clause. It says when you take a look at the financial statement, don't believe anything you read. This is up front. Don't believe anything you read. Some people call it a worthless clause because it makes the statement and anything you read in the statement worthless. It says go out and do your own research. Go out and do your own due diligence. You have to study the statement carefully. Do not believe anything. In fact, it's so strong that people read it and they don't even accept it. They don't even want it. They don't even use it. It's called a disclaimer clause. It's very common. If you put it in, if you don't have time to do statements, or even if you do have time, people like to have it. This is what's called a full disclaimer. We disclaim the financial statements. But even with a full disclaimer, which immediately takes you out of any fraud situation and any litigation. And by the way, when the Attorney General found out about the disclaimer clause, she said, that's okay, let's go forward anyway. It's good publicity. These are corrupt people we're dealing with. The most corrupt people.
Mike?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so and he's there. He's, what he's effectively saying is that he said this in the previous clip as well, is that if he hadn't bothered to run, that none of this would have been happening. So that, I mean, you know, I can see that. In fact, if you look at what's happened here to Boris Johnson, he's been hoofed out of the Conservative, well, not out of the party, but they were going to try and get him out of Parliament, etc. So he's moved out of the way. And it's almost as if Trump has actually decided that he's going to fight this, and he's going to fight it in public. And it might be that if Boris Johnson in the UK had decided he was going to fight it politically, fight it in the press, make all these statements about what he thinks is you know, going wrong with the country, that he'd have been potentially prosecuted too, like Trump has. But anyway, I just want to hear from you what you make of this particular court case in New York and how it fits with these other indictments that he's now under.
Well, I think that all of these indictments and court cases against Trump are a steaming pile of dog poop. I don't think they're legitimate at all. Trump is right. I've worked in mergers and acquisitions before, and what he's saying is that, you know, you have to do your own due diligence. The party who's selling a property, whether it's a business or a building or whatever, is going to represent it as beautifully as possible on paper. But it's up to you as the buyer to make sure you look under the hood. And if they say it's got a boiler in the basement, you better go look and see there's a boiler in the basement. So that's really what it is. He's done all that. He's dotted the I's. He's crossed the T's. He's really done what he's supposed to do as per business practice in the U.S. And now they want to prosecute him for this. It just doesn't make sense other than the political motive behind it. And if I may, can I go back and address Martin's comment about the Electoral College?
Of course, yeah.
You know, Martin, you're correct about the Electoral College. And the reason it exists is that in the United States, most of our population lives either on the East Coast or the West Coast. And we have this huge, vast tract of land that's in the middle. And the states that are in the middle wanted to be sure that they had a voice in how government ran. Otherwise, they would be dictated to by the East Coast, West Coast, power structures. And they wanted to make sure they had a voice. So that's why the Electoral College system was created, to ensure that all the states and all the people in the country have a voice, and not just the people who live on the East Coast or the West Coast. So I hope that brings some clarity.
Well, hang on, because, I mean, we in Britain, we had these rotten boroughs where there's hardly anybody there, but they still get the same vote as, say, a city like London with lots of people. So, it sounds a bit of an archaic system. Can you just explain? Is it a far less population, but they still get an equal vote with a very populous state, for example?
Well, it's not quite an equal vote, but they still have a voice. Their voice is not completely drowned out. You know, a state like Wyoming, which is one of the least populous states in the country, only has one electoral vote. But you look at a state like New York, who's got, I think, 30-plus electoral votes. And you look at California, which has the most electoral votes. And so they want to make sure that the accumulation of these smaller states in the middle still have a voice and are not drowned out.
Okay.
I understand that you don't want to give the same gravity. But the Electoral College is based on the population that you have in the state, as well as it's correlated with your representation within Congress. And so there is a system there that works. Most people don't understand it. It's big. It's clumsy. It's hard to grasp. But it does serve a purpose.
Well, it sounds a little bit anti-democratic. But anyway, that's not strange. We have the same sort of things go on here. Final clip. Donald Trump is comparing the situation here in New York with this indictment of him, what he says is a political indictment, and Russia.
We have a great company. I built a great company. It's got tremendous value. It's got some of the greatest real estate assets in the world. And now I have to go before a rogue judge as a continuation of Russia, 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 as a continuation of the greatest witch hunt of all time. And I don't think the people of this country are going to stand for it. If I weren't leading in all the polls, or if I weren't running, I wouldn't have any of these cases. I wouldn't be seeing you this morning. But I'll be seeing a lot of you, because this is a horrible thing that's happening to our country, and we've got to get it straightened away. So we'll go in and see our rogue judge, and we'll listen to this man. And I think most people get it. People are getting it. I can tell you the voters getting it, because every time they give me a fake indictment, I go up in the polls, and that's never happened before. But this is a disgrace, and you're to go after this attorney general, because she's turning off everybody from coming in. You know, I don't know if you take a look at the outflow of business. Businesses are fleeing New York because of horrible, horrible attorney generals and judges like we have. They go to other places where they can be treated fairly and with respect. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, so yeah, so there's Donald Trump there. He doesn't mention this whole business of Alison Greenfield and Chuck Schumer, but then he's been told not to by the judge. I don't think that's going to go down very well with the voters. Most people can see through that. Well, they're just trying to gag the guy because they want to control the case, and this is not justice. But what do you make of what he says there, Mike, about whether or not the American people will stand for it? He said he really doesn't think the U.S. Electorate, the voters, will stand for it.
I don't think they will either. We, as a U.S. citizen here, watching on January 6th what happened at our Capitol, I was cheering for the protesters. And I was happy that people were standing up and pushing back against what has obviously become a very corrupted system in the United States. And I blame this on guys like George Soros, who is funding these Democrat radical prosecutors who won't prosecute many felons, but yet go out and cherry pick and prosecute political opponents. And so I look at this as foreign interference in our process, in our election, and in our judicial process here, because all the things going on in New York with no longer having bail, catch and release for a criminal who's out on the street the same day, even if he's a murderer, these things are just absurd. And it's time that little common sense came back to the U.S. And I'm really hoping that sanity is restored in this country, because it's very unsettling living under these conditions.
Martin, what do you make of it? I mean, this is the headquarters of the empire, the Anglo-Zionist empire. A lot of Americans say Britain is the headquarters of the Anglo-Zionist empire. Some even say Israel is. but what do you make of the, because we've seen this, haven't we? These judicial coups in places like Brazil, etc. In many countries, actually, Brazil has had several. And so for this to actually come home to the United States, it's almost as if, a bit like the old structural adjustment programs that were foisted on African countries by the IMF. These tactics to control politics have been being used abroad, but they're now being used at the heart of the empire.
Well, I think they probably already always have. I think Donald Trump is right that this is a totally political prosecution. Well, I'm not somebody who would be in Donald Trump's political camp at all. But as you will see, our friend in the US will know that there are decent people on the left of politics in the US who have totally approached this prosecution as well. Because wrong is wrong and right is right. And of course, it's also totally counterproductive, because it's actually giving Donald Trump his electoral advantages that he's getting out of it. So it's just wrong. We haven't mentioned anything, of course, about Joe Biden and Hunter Biden and Burisma in Ukraine, because that's coming to a head as well in the US Congress. And the rest of the world is watching this clown show, as you called it earlier, and with the horrid fascination, because it's obviously important to everybody else. but we don't seem to have much control over it. Coming back to the question of the Electoral College stuff, no, can I just make one point about this, Tony?
Get on with it, then.
The real problem is that everybody in a state, whatever they vote for, all of their votes go to one side or the other. If it was not the case, it wouldn't matter. Because in actual fact, you would then... If in California, lots of people vote Republican. In Wyoming, quite a few people vote Democrat. But all of those votes are not counted. And that leads when you're at war with other countries which are more democratic, you're going to have a problem.
Let Mike just respond to that, please. Mike?
Well, first of all, let me agree with Martin on his point about the Electoral College, that it's all or nothing, whoever wins it. And that's one of the issues that I have a problem with, is the two-party system. As I told you before, I served as the finance chairman for the Republican Party. And this is a little-known secret that most Americans don't even know, and that is the top 10 donors to the Republican Party are the same top 10 donors to the Democrat Party. So the parties and the politicians respond to the donors more than they do the voters. And so we really don't have a two-party system. We have an illusion of a two-party system. What we have is a uniparty, because when the donors are calling the shot, when they're writing the check to fund these campaigns and things, it's a lot of show, but the donors always get their way. They always win. They're like insurance companies that hedge their bets.
Yeah, it's a bit like a kind of A team and a B team, and we're feeling rather like the American system is now being imposed here in Britain, where we've got the Labour Party is the British B team. But on Trump, back to Trump, because I do find this the persecution of him. I mean, witch hunt is exactly the way we described in Britain, the way that that many of the Corbynistas have been persecuted and suspended and booted out unceremoniously from the Labour Party, a witch hunt. You know, there's a lot of witch hunts going around, all basically, going back to the McCarthy era, a lot of comparisons being made with those. But the Fox News presenter who was booted out in the case between Fox News and Dominion Voting, he has been saying this week about the campaign to stop Donald Trump standing to be president.
What do you think the future holds? Is it?
I don't know.
I mean, are they going to let Trump be president?
No, of course. I mean, look, if they protested him, they called him names. He won anyway. They impeached him twice on ridiculous pretenses. They fabricated a lot about what happened on January 6th in order to impeach him again. It didn't work. He came back. Then they indicted him. It didn't work. He became more popular. Then they indicted him three more times. And every single time his popularity rose. So if you begin with criticism, then you go to protest, then you go to impeachment, now you go to indictment, and none of them work, what's next? I mean, graph it out, man. We're speeding toward assassination, obviously, and no one will say that. But I don't know how you can reach that conclusion.
Well, that's Mike. What do you make of that? Tucker Carlson, even though he's of course been booted off Fox News on Twitter or somewhere else, I think maybe someone else's show on YouTube there, saying he thinks that it's feasible that Trump may be assassinated.
Well, the U.S. government is not shy about assassinating up-and-coming political candidates. We watched the murder of John F. Kennedy in broad daylight in Daley Plaza. We watched the murder of his brother. We watched the murder of Martin Luther King. We watched the murder of Larry McDonald, who blew up in an aircraft. We watched who is the guy in Minnesota who they crashed his plane as well, I forget. But we see this in the U.S. when they're desperate, when they have effective people who are opposing their agenda of the deep state. They're not afraid to pull the trigger and kill these people. I fear this could be what happens to Trump. And I just read an article yesterday that one of Trump's biggest fears is of being poisoned. So he won't use a ketchup out of a big jar. He'll only use an individual packet that's individually sealed. So it's kind of interesting how these things work, how they manifest. But I think Tucker Carlson is right that the potential for assassination is definitely there. One of the reasons I believe he is still alive, that not only did he accept his Secret Service detail, but in addition to that, he has a rotating private security company, which also provides protection for him as well, to keep the Secret Service honest, because it's come to light that in the murder of JFK, John F. Kennedy, that the Secret Service may have been involved, and it's a risk you cannot take. Every other sector of government has been weaponized against Trump and against the populist MAGA movement. So why wouldn't they also weaponize the Secret Service?
Well, I can tell you, the CIA and the FBI were both weaponized against John F. Kennedy, as well as the Chicago Mafia. And that was an operation which was run by David Attlee Phillips, who was the controller of the assassination. He was CIA, but they also made sure that Hoover was involved as well. So that the FBI would be covering it up after it happened. So, you know, these are the facts of the matter. James Files, Charles Nicoletti, and Johnny Roselli were all down from hitmen from the Chicago Mafia down in Dallas that fateful day in 1963. But so it's feasible that the deep state, Martin, what do you think of this idea that the deep state might actually finally turn on him and say, well, if he's rising in the polls every time we try and do a prosecution and an indictment, that we're going to have to dispatch him by other means?
Well, I mean, Trump is about the same age as Putin, and of course in the propaganda we get in the Western world, Putin's dying of cancer, he's on his last legs, and of course he's pretty fit because he used to be a Secret Service guy and he's done judo and so on. But I mean, Trump is an old guy and he could just have a heart attack. That wouldn't be an assassination, would it? Except it probably would be. These are the kind of thoughts I would be having if I was the deep state. You'd have to shoot him in the head.
I mean, the thing is, we had a lot of promises from Trump the first time, didn't we, about sorting out, draining the swamp. Do you think it's feasible that he might actually, if he was to gain a second term, then he might actually be able to deal with the swamp to actually cast the deep state into outer darkness? Surely that's going to be virtually impossible, even if he is president of the United States again.
Who are you asking?
Mike, you.
Oh, okay. Well, that is the question right there. The rookie mistake that Trump made in his first term, you have to realize that personnel is policy. And Trump was not wise in his personnel assignment there. He pulled too many people out of the Bush crime family and put them into positions of power there. William Barr comes to mind. What's the other guy's name? John Bolton. Many of these guys were straight off the Bush team. Why are you going to put them into power in your new administration when you want to affect change, when they were the neocon base that worked for Bush, that Obama took over, and it's just a carryover? I mean, like I said, we don't have a two-party system. We have a uniparty here that just pretends it has two parties. You can have a left wing and a right wing, but they both belong on the same bird. And that's one of the problems that we have here. And Trump made a very tragic mistake with that the people he put in to make the changes didn't make the change. Then we have the problem of what is called the senior executive service. And these are bureaucrats that run the government in spite of whoever is elected. They're there. And if they're leaning to the left, they're going to lean to the left, they're going to enforce the policies in a leftward manner. If they lean to the right, they're going to enforce the policies in a rightward manner. And we've got to restructure our entire government from the foundation to the rafters and be able to change it. Because the good news is, with all this, what's going on around Trump and all the corruption that's coming out and becoming apparent, is we can see where the weaknesses are in our constitutional Republican form of government. It has illustrated this very, very clearly to us. When we have ancient people like Dianne Feinstein, who just died last week, 90 years old, been in the Senate for 30, 35 years. Mitch McConnell's no better. He keeps having these seizures where he freezes up. These people are too old to
And of course the president himself, most definitely. But look, I mean, what we're talking about here is a kind of clique-run government. So it's friends of friends who just do what they're told to do. They're very pliable. But there are some that say that actually the secret societies, Freemasonry, etc., play a big role in making sure that the clique stays very, very tight, and that they're really very also secretive about their associations and what their true aims are.
I agree that is another problem. So How do the question comes to the American people is how do we address these things? And if we're going to maintain our constitutional republic in this country, how do we purge it of these problems? And, you know, how do we have the political will to do that? Or are we just going to get rolled and end up
in
a totalitarian state?
Well, we shall see. Well, look, what we've got is a bit of a battle going on, isn't there, over the whether or not the country can continue to pay its civil servants and whether the money should still go to Ukraine. Can you just bring us up to date on how this little tug of war is going with those that think that we should, you know, basically send as much money and resources as Zelensky needs in order to lose the war against Russia?
Well, first you have to realize that the U.S. is not defending democracy in Ukraine. The U.S. issued a coup in Ukraine. What's her name? Victoria Nuland spent $5 billion U.S. dollars to topple the democratically elected government of Viktor Yanukovych and installed their own U.S. puppets, just like they did in Iran in 1953 when they installed the Shah. That's what they did. And Putin reacted to this. And I think wisely reacted to this because you look at the revelations that all of the secret bioweapon laboratories that are in Ukraine developing these toxic pathogens that are targeted to kill Slavic Russians. This is a clear and present danger. This is something the U.S. would not tolerate if it was happening in Mexico. Why would Putin tolerate it in Ukraine? But this is what's going on. We have the United States is no longer responsive to the will of the people. The United States is responsive to the will of the big donors.
Well, I mean, but hang on, because surely in your political system at the moment, there's quite a lot of voices and votes saying, well, actually, we should stop funding Ukraine.
Well, I agree with that because the U.S. caused the problem there. This was not Putin's doing. Putin reacted to what the U.S. did in his neighboring country. And like I said, Zelensky, this is not a democratic government. He outlawed all other political parties. He's postponed elections indefinitely. You know, Zelensky is a dictator. And we're supporting a dictator who is also supporting Nazis. And we're supposed to go along with this and say, oh, yeah, that's great. Unlimited resources for Zelensky when we have a homeless problem, a drug problem, an open border problem in our own country that is going unattended. It's like on the airlines, you know, how you get on an airplane and everybody's seated, they're getting ready to take off. The flight attendant says, in the event of the cabin depressurizes, put on your mask first, then help someone. You got to take care of yourself first. And the United States is busy taking care of Ukraine and not its own business. And so, you know, in the flight analogy I gave, you're going to pass out before you can get the mask on the guy next to you. So who's going to help you? You got to take care of yourself. The United States has to take care of itself. We have a massive debt problem. We have all of these internal problems here that are just festering. And yet we've given $142 billion in military aid to Ukraine and an additional $25 billion to them in other governmental aid. Debt broke and we're $33 trillion in debt. Plus we have another $250 trillion in unfunded government mandates. And then Wall Street has the derivatives problem. The United States is in for a very, very hard financial
They're that hard. I noticed on antiwar.com today, a desperate White House is scrambling to find the money for army. Never mind if they're going to even vote it. They haven't actually got the money. Apparently, after Congress failed to pass a $24 billion aid package for Kiev during the budget debate, the Joe Biden administration is now considering a range of options to try and find the money. So Politico reported on Thursday that President Biden was contemplating using State Department funds to ship weapons to Ukraine. Washington and Kiev are beginning to panic as Congress did not pass Biden's proposed $24 billion aid package to Ukraine last month. There's an incredible amount of reluctance. And also, at the same time, the European Union is saying, Mike, that it can't support Ukraine without the US. So this whole support for Ukraine, and maybe you could say something about this as well in a minute, Martin, seems to be crumbling.
Well, it is. I never supported the action in Ukraine. I think that it's, you know, as a United States citizen, someone who lives here, I've been to Ukraine many times, you know, starting in 2004. I've been there a number of times. It is an extremely corrupt country. But it serves a purpose in that today there is releasing of which politicians in the U.S. are receiving kickbacks from Ukraine. Money laundered through Sam Brinkman Fried's FTX. So it's really a convoluted and very corrupt.
So all this kind of money to Ukraine, quite a lot of it is actually money coming bouncing straight back, Martin.
Yeah, here I can read a list to you if you want. Joe Biden got $92 million. Mitch McConnell got $89 million. Nancy Pelosi, $86 million. Chuck Schumer, $66 million. Lindsey Graham got $82 million. Mitt Romney, $71 million. John Cornyn, $41 million. Adam Schiff, $62 million. Dan Crenshaw, $20 million. Elizabeth Cheney, $77 million. Kevin McCarthy, $42 million. Jamie Raskin, $38 million. Mike Pence, $61 million. Greg Pence, $17 million. Rick Scott, $63 million. Hakeem Jeffries, $74 million. Ilhan Omar, $33 million. And Elizabeth Warren, $42
can
million.
Can you just give us the source for that?
Real SG Anon.
And I don't know, is it on that website that you do, the Intel Drop?
No, it's not on that website yet. We'll get it up there soon.
Okay, brilliant. Martin, your final thoughts on this running out of money in America to give to Ukraine and the Europeans saying, well, if you don't, neither are we. It does seem as it may be coming to a bit of a grinding halt.
Well, it's obviously coming to an inflection point. I mean, Bill Kristol, the neocon, has put together an ad that I've seen circulating in the US about how this is great money well spent, because we're destroying the Russians without any American lives being lost, and also that in actual fact a lot of this money is coming back to the congressional districts near you, to the arms industry that employs you all. So, you know, what's not to like about this? And of course, what Ben Wallace in this country, the former Minister of Defense, Defense Secretary, saying that the Ukrainians now need to mobilize all of their teenage boys to die because we've given them such a lot of money and we've been so generous to them that, you know, it's time for them to sacrifice their eldest born to Moloch here. I mean, it's just depraved, the whole thing.
But in the meantime, at least 80 have been killed today in a drone attack on a Syrian military college ceremony. That. Members of the armed forces and civilians are among the dead. 80 people have been killed in a drone attack targeted a graduation ceremony at a military college in God Almighty in Syria, central Homs province, on Thursday. The country's health minister has said Syrian government said members of the armed forces and civilians were among the casualties. Health Minister Hassan Gaba said the 80 killed included 6 women, 6 children. 240 were wounded. UK-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights put the death toll higher, saying 100 people have been killed. The number isn't confirmed. Syrian Defence Minister Ali Abbas was present at the graduating ceremony. Reports say he left about 20 minutes before the drone bombardment. Syria's military said the attack was conducted by armed terrorist organisations supported by well-known international parties. For you first, Martin, who's behind this?
It's clearly the Western powers working through probably the Al Qaeda groups based in Idlib. Probably there's another Ukrainian atrocity this week as well, with the blowing up of this party in a cafe in East Ukraine. There are two theories running around about that. One is that it's another Ukrainian false flag to try and drum up support in the West. The other is that in actual fact this was actually a wake for a senior Nazi commander, and all these people were there, and that's why the Russians may have actually dropped the but it's been presented in the West as another atrocity by the terrible Russians.
So what do you make of Syria? Who do you think might be behind that, Mike?
Well, first of all, I've been to Syria several times, beginning 2014, 15, and 16, as a guest of the Syrian Minister of Justice. And I like the Syrian people, but they're under attack from outside parties. And this is primarily the U.S., the U.K., Saudi Arabia, and Israel are the ones who are funding ISIS.
So who do you think most likely to have been behind this drone? Or is it, you know, obviously this is not just the people who are the proxy warriors for the Anglo-Zionist Empire, but somebody will be behind this. Is it the Israelis, do you think, the Americans?
Well, Israel has the most to gain. So whenever something like this happens, there's two questions you have to ask yourself. Who benefits and why now? Okay, so you answer those questions, you will have a much better insight as to who is behind it and why they're doing it. The goal has been all along has been to topple the regime of Bashar al-Assad. Being there on the ground, talking with Syrian people, this man is loved by his people, and quite frankly, he's done a brilliant job holding the country together under such adverse circumstances. But the Minister of Justice shared with us, the group I was with, a listing of all of the terrorists in Syria, all the ISIS terrorists in Syria, everything they had on them. They gave us their names, their addresses, their entire dossiers. And so then you look a little deeper, you peel deeper. Most of these are foreign fighters who were brought in there and being paid. So the question inevitably has to be asked is, who is paying for this? Where's the money come from? Who's buying their fuel? Who's buying their food? Who's buying their ammunition, their arms? Who's paying for it? You solve that, you know who it is. And like I just said, Turkey has a stake in this. Saudi Arabia has a stake in this. Israel has a stake in this. The U.S. and the U.K. Those are the sources. Now, who actually paid for this incident, I have no idea.
Martin, do you want to just give a bit of a guess about who's the command structure behind this?
Well, as our friend is saying, we don't know for sure who's behind it, but we know who's benefiting from it. I think that Saudi Arabia has actually been coming to some kind of understanding with Assad in recent times. So I suggest that this is probably the usual suspects. It's the US neocon deep state.
Interesting, isn't it? I mean, Israelis, it seems to me, the obvious culprits potentially. But the idea of murdering all these military graduates is obviously the idea is that before they even... This is an ideal time to kill people, I suppose, just as they're about to embark on a military career. They've probably been extremely well trained. They're probably young and enthusiastic. And of course, it sends a particularly horrific, message of morale. And, you know, destroys the morale of a nation to carry out atrocities like this. And it may be that, the Syrians decide they want to retaliate in some way for something which is such a horrific blow against their ability to defend themselves for decades into the future. But I'd like to finally look at another aspect to all of this, which is child trafficking. And we had a report on our ITV news here about Ukraine child trafficking, and in fact not just Ukraine but other countries, via Malta. So let's have a little listen to that now.
Malta is better known as a quiet holiday destination, a place for luxury yachts, a world away from the chaos of people smuggling in Calais and the small boats crossing the channel there. But an ITV News investigation has uncovered how this place has become the fastest growing entry point to Europe for Vietnamese people smuggling gangs. We meet one man who tells us he borrowed almost £15,000 to pay an agent in Vietnam for a legal Maltese visa, but along with hundreds of others that we know of, he came here with the intention of being smuggled illegally onwards to work in Germany or the UK.
I didn't even know where Malta was before this, but the agent told me the student visa was a good option they were using as a route for anyone trying to get into Europe to work. I had to borrow money secured against my house and land to pay them, but they said I could get a job and pay that back within a few years.
So that's the little clip, and I'll put the full report from ITV up there, where they talk about other nations as well. But I tracked down this guy we heard a lot of news about last week, Warren Thornton, who's one of those who dug out the evidence about the Canadian Nazi war record and the fact that he was in the Galicia Division and the Waffen SS. In fact, he got his war record out, which is one of the reasons that the Jewish lobby in Canada demanded that something be done about the idea of having a sort of mass applause and standing ovation for a former Waffen SS officer by led by Justin Trudeau. But anyway, Warren was one of those that dug it out, and I spoke to him earlier this week about this whole business of this is he believes an unfolding story about Ukrainian child trafficking via Malta.
We've got some big info on trafficking that's going to come out, and we've also got, which involves fairly high level Ukrainian people and also fairly high level British people and a go-between. We've also got a story.
Hang on, stop you a second, because all I've seen is stories about the Russians doing child trafficking. What they're saying is they are snatching young children and orphans mainly and bringing them over into Russia.
Yeah, and that was blown up at the UN, because when Russia were the chair of the UN, they brought out all these videos showing that the mothers, fathers and everything else were all leaving on ferries. They were all coming to Russia. They were showing the videos of all the kids. And the four countries that got up and walked out of the UN were Moldova, Albania, UK and the USA, because they were caught in lying. Now, these four have been absolutely systemic in this child trafficking thing that's going on, because what happens is the Albanian drug gangs in London have now stopped selling drugs because it's far more profitable to trade in children. So they go to Moldova, where they pick up and pay for false passports. They then go to a Ukrainian orphanage, where they pick up these children, and they take these children and they take them to Malta, and then they fly out from Malta to the UK. We don't know what happens to them once they get...
Hang on, are these on scheduled flights or what?
Oh, yeah, they get them on scheduled flights, because what they do is the child is selected in Ukraine. Then what happens is an Albanian drug trafficking guy will come over. He will pick up false documents from Moldova after paying a sum of money. What will happen then is they will use this to go and pick up a child saying it's their child, and they will fly them out from a destination, normally Malta. And then they come to the UK. What we do know, we don't know addresses and everything else, but they take them from the UK. And if they're travelling to America, they go north, private airfield into Ireland, and then thence from Ireland into America.
I'm a little bit concerned that you're telling me this. Surely you should be telling the Avon and Somerset Police, or you should be telling the National Crime Agency.
There are MI6 people wrapped up in this. When this breaks, when this comes out, there are people all over the place that are wrapped up in this. We're talking people in high-level charities, and we, a colleague who has got all the information as well as I have, went to the NCA. And went to them, and they do, and the next thing we know is she's had her LinkedIn looked at by one of the people who's involved in this.
Well, hang on, because that implies, doesn't it, that either the National Crime Agency has been infiltrated, so they have organised crime personnel inside the National Crime Agency, or that their computer systems are hacked or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely it does.
It's impossible to prosecute people if they're one step ahead of you.
Yeah, and absolutely it does. That's why probably we have to get it out there as fast as possible for our own safety.
Yeah, what do you think these... do you have any knowledge of what these children are being used for? What destination? It's obviously not good.
Yeah, they're selected in children's homes, so they're taken from the mother, and I'll be able to send you some stuff tonight so you can have it on record. They're selected from children's homes, they're taken from the war-torn areas, put into children's homes, and then there is literally a shopping list for what you want. And the main topic that they're looking for are girls 10 years of age or under with blue eyes. That's the shopping list. That's the main target.
I mean, there might be childless couples that want a kid. I mean, that might, you know, in a sort of almost like unofficial adoption.
Yeah, you don't go through private military companies to adopt a small child. I'm sorry, you really don't.
So that's Warren Thornton there speaking to me earlier this week, a longer interview, as there is with the one with David Halpin earlier, on this topic of child trafficking. Mike, I wonder what you make of that.
Well, I'm not an expert on child trafficking, but during my times in Ukraine, one thing I noticed what was quite common is that young girls, 14, 15, 16 years old, would often be promised a job overseas, and they would take the job because the poverty in Ukraine before the war was very bad. It's a very poor country. I mean, everything is being stolen by these Jewish oligarchs. And these girls would be promised a job. They end up who knows where. Israel is a big destination target. Dubai is another one. And they use them in the sex trade. They use them as prostitutes until they wear them out. And then the girl is broken up for body parts, for organ harvesting, and never heard or seen from again. And I know that has happened. I know it's gone on. Israel is one of the greatest offenders on this. And everybody talks about the Red Mafia, and you have to understand something. They may live in Russia and have a Russian passport, but most of the time these are Khazarian Zionist Jews who are doing these things. These are the most ruthless, brutal people on the planet. And it's about time that the world started looking at them through that lens.
Okay, so Martin, what do you make of this? I mean, you've got the idea of international child traffickers really getting involved with, basically an opportunity presented by the chaos of war. It's not just the rebuilding contracts they're looking at; it's potentially human trafficking and as Mike mentioned, there organ trafficking. You've got all these dead bodies coming back from the front. Someone might decide they want to sell on their organs.
Well. Ukraine, quite rightly, is perceived as one of the most corrupt countries in the world because the so-called reform of the economy in Russia and Ukraine was just a disaster in the 1990s. Living standards collapsed, the life expectancy went through the floor, and it wasn't that high in the first place. And what's happened in Russia is that they've gradually managed to turn the situation around, and for the state to get some kind of control over the economy again and to be able to manage things. Ukraine never went through that process. And there's an awful lot of the weaponry that's being sent to the Ukraine, which is, I was reading this week, it's all ending up in the hands of criminal gangs all over the world. Because, there's a lot of money to be made. And war profiteering is really what Zelensky is all about and the clique around him. They're out there collecting money so that they can carry on doing gangsterish things. But, Semyon Mogilevich, the head of the Russian mafia, many of these people are, as you say, of Jewish origin. That doesn't mean all Jews are criminals. It means these people are criminals. And of course, they're well embedded into, Western intelligence structures, including MI6 and the CIA. Well, They've been involved in the drugs trade for years. This is what we're dealing with.
I use the term Zionist, really, rather than Jewish. I mean, because this is a particular type.
These people are gangsters. First and foremost.
So you're talking about the Jewish mafia or the Zionist mafia?
I'm just saying that Semyon Mogilevich may or may not have views about Zionism, but he is Jewish and he's a gangster.
Some of these individuals don't support the State of Israel, do they?
Well, I mean, Colin Moisky, who was...
He supports Israel.
Yes, he does.
Is anyone that doesn't support Israel?
I'm just making the point, Tony, that these Jewish gangsters from the Soviet Union and Ukraine are not necessarily that political. Many of them are Zionists. Yeah. I mean, Sheldon Adelson in the US, the biggest contributor to US politics, anyway, undoubtedly a Zionist.
Let's let Mike wrap up here, yeah. And also maybe Mike, you can tell us if you can wrap up, Mike, and also let us know where we can follow your work. Where would you recommend?
Let me bring some clarity here for you. Okay, that is, I use the term Khazarian Mafia for this because that takes away from the Jewishness, takes away from Zionism, so it's not political. But it is the country of origin from which all the Ashkenazi come from. And so no one wants to be called anti-Semitic, so we had to change the language. And so Khazarian Mafia is the adapted term that I use. You can find my work on primarily three sites. One of them is the Intel Drop that you mentioned earlier, theinteldrop.com. Then veteranstoday.com. I have a huge archive of material in there. And then I've been appearing lately on... Global Freedom Television on Monday nights with Lieutenant Scott Bennett. And so if you wish to follow me, those are the places that you can find me.
Okay, so, well, Mike,
and I think, Tony, yep. Martin, I want to thank you both for having me on. I mean, Martin, I'm impressed with your intellect and how you parse the issues. Very well done, sir.
Well, nice to talk to you as well.
Okay, Mike Harris, thanks ever so much for joining us again. And, Intel Drop. Do you want to just say something a little bit about that? I find it a fascinating site. I drop in from time to time. Always something interesting there. Is it a sort of collaborative thing, is it?
Yes, it is. Intel Drop is really real news. It's real news. It's the thing that, the guys I work with, Gordon Duff and others in particular, is that whenever we write an article or publish an article, we have boots on the ground. If I want to know something going on in Ukraine, I call people I know in Ukraine. I talk to them.
Yeah.
I'll go visit them. If I want to know something in Syria, I'll call people I know in Syria. So we get real reporting from people who are on the ground in the area can tell us, yes, it's going on,
okay.
No, it's not.
Look, one last story. I know it's very cheeky of me to ask you this, but we had a story last week about someone called Private Travis King. He was defected to North Korea, but the North Koreans then just handed him back, which does sound bizarre. Surely they could have scored a propaganda victory. Can you just untangle that? What was really that about?
Well, the issue with Private King, I think it's going to be revealed here rather shortly, that Private King has some rather severe emotional and mental illness problems. And so the North Koreans couldn't make very good propaganda.
Okay. Well, that's great.
Show very well.
That's very good that you could clear that up. Anyway, Mike, thanks ever so much for joining us. We'll speak to you again.
Thank you so much, sir. Please stay in touch.
We'll do, of course. And we're going to round off tonight with a piece from David Livingstone, who's the author of Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea. And I love checking in with him from time to time, as I think he explains the kind of occult angle of much of this. And I'd like you to hang on for this as well, Martin, because here he talks in a longer interview, which will be up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk, about the background to MKUltra and the CIA's use of drugs.
It comes from an occult belief, right? So this is not what you're seeing is not going to be news to Aldous Huxley. Right. Huxley was a firm believer in what's called the perennial philosophy. So he believed in this whole idea, really popularized by René Guénon, of a single esoteric tradition that links all of the, which is the core of the, sorry, a single occult tradition, which is the core of the various esoteric traditions of the exoteric religions. So that's what it comes down to. It's the belief in achieving, this is why they described it, this is why they, you know, the whole purpose of occultism is to make contact with entities, right? And black magic is the performance of various rituals to make contact with these entities and then to either gain knowledge from them or to use them to carry out acts in your favor. So that's why it's regarded that the shamans are so-called these ancient witch doctors. This is what they did. And so what happened to them is for various actions that they would perform, they would achieve a trance state, which is much normally, you know, understood as being a state of demonic possession. So for these occultists, well, the way they translated into modern clinical language is as schizophrenia. And so schizophrenics basically experience the same thing for the most part, are victims of psychic attack. Usually they hear voices and things like that, and which is, again, an example of a demonic activity. So, again, this is how occultists view it. So this is why they described it for the rest of us as schizophrenia, but yeah, they understood it as trying to emulate the trance states of the ancient shamans, which they knew was partly achieved through drugs.
Well, isn't it interesting, the sort of almost tug of war that's gone on between people of the Judeo-Christian religions mainly, but also the kind of psychiatric profession pulling in the other direction, just poo-pooing this idea of demonic possession?
Yes. I mean, the thing is, there's a fascinating history about how even the field of psychology itself grew out of the study of occult phenomena. If you look at the founders of the field of psychology were mostly linked to the study of trying to prove psychic abilities. A lot of it had to do with also the study of ectoplasm. I don't know if you know what that is, but a lot of times people in trance states or, you know, produce this substance which is referred to as an ectoplasm. It's popularized in the Ghostbusters movies as a slime. But you can see that there's various photographs that they took of this material. But then what's strange is that you get this simultaneous outgrowth of what's called the Society for Psychical Research, I think is what it's called, which involved, what's curious is that it involved a lot of people who were deeply connected to theosophy, but they ended up supposedly disproving or, you know, proving Blavatsky to be a fraud. But so I don't know how it exactly happened, but basically it grew out of that, but then sort of developed this scientific, empirical look at the world that purportedly rejected the existence of the supernatural.
So that's there's a longer interview, nearly 45 minutes, that I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. I'll probably use another clip next week. Fascinating guy. I always find him absolutely riveting. But Martin, of course, you'd be one of those that would say, well, this is nothing to do with demonic possession or this use of drugs and psychiatric illnesses, wouldn't you?
Well, I would suggest that there is a definite history or prehistory of shamanism as part of human culture. Before we had organized modern religions, you know, like Egyptian religion or Christianity or Hinduism, Islam. Hinduism has probably got more shamanistic aspects than other religions.
Well, isn't our present sort of Judeo-Christian tradition here being replaced by a kind of Hinduism?
Well, no, because no, Tony, in actual fact, you've got various religious traditions and you've also got shamanistic traditions. There are still, we had people from the talking about Amazon tribes here the other week. Some Amazon tribes still exist and they haven't been contacted by the outside world. They will probably have what we would call shamanistic beliefs, beliefs that everything around them has a spirit. Now, I think there's a lot of...
This is pantheism.
Sorry?
Pantheism.
Well, they wouldn't use that
word.
They
won't, but we will.
No, yes.
Because that's what they are.
Yeah, but I mean, the point is that you're trying to put all of these very varied phenomena in various boxes and put labels on them. In actual fact, human psychology and human beliefs are incredibly varied. And
well, it's called journalism. That's what journalists do.
Yeah, okay.
You know, you say, well, hang on, this is that, and this is that. Though it says it's something else, it's not, it's that.
Well, no, because no, Tony, that's not journalism, that's reductionism. That's making everything, I've got the explanation for everything.
Well, everybody's got a different explanation for things.
No, that's right, because in actual fact, journalism is looking into things and asking questions. You're trying to say, well, I've got the answers. That's not journalism.
No, I'm looking into it, and I think David Livingstone's got a lot of answers.
Okay,
his study of transhumanism, what he's done is he's shown that a lot of the things that we're seeing now, for example, the idea of machines taking over from people and human beings being slaves to computers, these are very old ideas.
Well, they are. They're technocratic fascist ideas, if you like, and they've been around for a long time. And that doesn't, you know, that is not the sum total of human experience over many generations.
I don't think anyone's saying it is. But anyway, time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, writer and blogger and journalist Mike Harris from the United States. Also, particularly to David Halpin for his contribution. As I said, a longer version of that interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, as well as that interview you just heard a clip from there with David Livingstone, the author of many books. The most interesting to most people is his book about transhumanism, entitled Transhumanism, the History of a Dangerous Idea. Also thanks to sound engineer struggling sometimes with the link over to the United States tonight, Dave Bazanko. You can download MP3s or listen in the car or anywhere you like if you want to do that. You can also follow Tony Gosling Censored on the Telegram channel. Do please send me interviews, story tips, and even music via Not the BCFM Politics Show page. We'll also find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links, the comment page, and our email addresses. You can subscribe to my weekly email list and even donate at thisweek.org.uk. Yes, that email list usually goes out on a Sunday night and it's got links to all the stories that we're dealing with. Make sure that there's that chart of the per capita national contributions to carbon in the atmosphere. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
We will not comply with the institution's sick illusion. No, it won't be televised. Welcome to the revolution. Welcome to
gotta step aside. Witnessing a genocide, everything is centralized. The food that we consume and they spraying it out with pesticides. Easily identify the sheep and the snake, the real and the fake, giving us a reason to pray. I'ma make my own choices, a voice for the voiceless. They trying to destroy us, avoiding the poison. It's all pointless if you don't have a purpose. If you read the verses, you'll know who we versing. Government can't tell you what your worth is, look deeper than the surface. They don't even want you researching or asking questions. We all being tested. Shut your mouth, they comply, that's the message. Want you depressed on prescriptions that mess with your head. Got you stressing, suppressing expression.
We will not comply with the institutions. Sick illusion, no, it won't be televised. Welcome to the revolution. We will not comply.
My soul, they want power and control. That's their number one goal. All my friends turn to foes. Look how easily they fold. Even Nazis say they were doing what they told. Walking down this road all alone in the cold, but my soul never sold. I'm exposing the clones. God has chosen this role. All of those who oppose want me hopeless and broke, like I'm nowhere on boats. I'm just trying to tell them all about the flood. I can feel it in my bones, I can feel it in my blood. Man, I came up out the mud. Only God is my judge. I don't listen to these politicians, they the real thugs. Won't comply with the lies, they disguise it in science. They want you compliant, the media's biased. These corporate giants are capitalized.